last part of the five-part All Hell is Breaking Loose, the history of Continental Championship Wrestling, USA Wrestling, Continental Wrestling Federation series. And it's kind of bittersweet that it's come to an end. But, yeah, it's been four great shows so far, and this show hopefully will be just as good, if not better. So we'll get right into it, and I'm joined, as usual, by my co-host in this series, Bo James, the King of Kingsport. Bo, how are you doing today?
I have had one of the most stressful days of my life today. I have been in West Virginia delivering to the flood victims. So I actually, as we're recording this, I have been home less than an hour, and I have been up for almost 48 hours. So if I get crazy, excuse me.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that at the end of the show, so you can, yeah, you know, give a full, you know, detailed situation going on there and how people can help out. But first off, what I really want to do before we get started talking about Continental was, there's something else that happened that you were involved with in a way this weekend, which you went to the Gypsy Joe's funeral, and tell everybody how that went.
Wonderful service for Joe. I knew Joe for 25 years, maybe a little longer. Joe was rough and gruff, you know, tough as they come, tough as nails. He was hard to break that wall down to get to know Joe. But once you got it and you got to know him, you know, you had a heck of a friend. You had a heck of a guy in your corner. And, you know, the guy, the last few years of his life, he just had all kinds of health problems, you know, which it was just so sad to watch him go from knowing what he was to, you know, what he was at the end. But great service. Tim Renesto Jr. was there. Tim Renesto was there. Dr. Tom Pritchard was there. Chris Champion, Tony and LT Falk, almost every wrestler you could think of from the Middle Tennessee independence from the last 20 years was there. Lots of wrestling fans, people that lived near Joe over the years. I mean, just the building was, as I told my dad went down to with us. Dad knew Joe for years. He went with me and Misty. And I told him coming home, Joe had one more sellout. I mean, the funeral home was packed. And they did something, you know, in Japan. I don't know, Chris, if they still, because I've not watched in years. But, you know, like when Joe retired, they picked him up in the air. You know, they threw him up in the air.
That's the thing in Japanese wrestling back in the day.
Right. Because, you know, you're touching, you know, what it is, the symbolism is, everybody's life that you touched in the business, they're touching you on the way out. Well, there was 8 pallbearers, and then he had honorary pallbearers, which was anybody that he had wrestled with. And they were somewhere between 40 and 50 of us. And when they took him out of the hearse, they passed him down the line, all the way from the hearse, all the way to the grave. And it was just something to see, and that's what he wanted. And they played a great video of him that the funeral home had put together with what they at the time they had and what they had. You know, his daughter had these, like, not cork boards, but they were nice boards out there, were full of pictures and slammograms and Japanese booking sheets and TV sheets from Montreal and Montreal poster and programs from all over the world that he was in. I mean, it was like a museum up front there with just all the stuff, and just something to see. And Joe is one of those guys now, he was before the internet. So he is really not known for what he did, because most of the wrestling fans of that time are not around anymore. That, I mean, even the ones that are around, they don't follow wrestling anymore. But Joe was a huge star. It was a fitting tribute. He unfortunately did not have any insurance to pay for his funeral, pay for everything. The funeral home, and at the end of the program, I'll get back to this because I don't have it in front of me just yet. They did a great deal, and they did it without any money down. We raised $4,000. To pay towards your funeral. There's about $2,500 left. If anybody would like to make a donation to help his family pay off the funeral, you know, if it's $10, $20, $50, you know, whatever. I'll give you some information at the end of the program about that. Just help Joe out. And here's the wonderful thing the funeral director did, because he grew up a wrestling fan. He said, donate the price of a ringside seat.
There you go.
And a lot of people did that, and they raised a lot of money to take care of it, and there's still a little bit left. So, but, you know, Joe, my amigo, he was my friend for many years, and I'm going to miss him. But the stories are going to live on forever, because there was only one Gypsy Joe. There'll never be another like him. There'll never be a guy that's going to wrestle for seven decades. There's never going to be, you know, there's never going to be a guy that headlines across the world for a dozen different promotions, you know, and he wrestled in places that a lot of people didn't even know they had wrestling, like Korea, China, Cuba. I mean, his resume was unmatched as far as if, you know, a lot of people may go to those places for WWE, but he went there for different offices because they called him and contacted him and wanted him to come there.
He was, you know, a guy who he was willing to go anywhere. A lot of guys wouldn't be willing to do what he did. He was a true world traveler.
Yeah, he was a real gypsy.
He was, basically. And, you know, Joe would work here and there. Like, he didn't, the main offices that he worked, where he worked for Nick Gulas, he worked in Memphis. He did, you know, some TV work for Georgia in 81. There's a match with Flair that is around that I know I have. It's not online.
I've got it too.
He had a match with Flair on television. He worked, and of course, his last real well-known American run was El Grande Pistolero for Jarrett in Texas, in Dallas, in 1991. Yeah. So, Joe was it. And a lot of people remember Joe for the whole deal with New Jack and all that stuff, in the early 2000s.
And if that's what you know him for, shame on you. Go look and find more about him. Because there's stuff out there.
I mean, you just watch his Japanese stuff, and you'll get it then, because he was a legend in the 70s in Japan.
I will tell you, let me tell you a funny story real fast about before we get into Continental about Joe. Joe would hit you hard. And when I met him, you know, he was still all man and yard wide and thick. And just, you know, he just would let you beat on him. But you better know he's going to beat on you back. But me, when he hit me, I went down, because I'm not an idiot. I'm not going to stand there and trade chops with him, because you can't hurt him and he's just going to beat you to death. So, but the first time that Misty ever saw Joe was before she started wrestling, was against me, and we're in Tullahoma, Tennessee, and we're working a little bit, and Joe tells me hard way. I said, no. He said, you better hard way. I said, no. He said, I'm telling you hard way me, with a few other choice words. Yeah. I said, okay. So I grabbed him in the side headlock and I punched him right in the eye, hard way. Blood's going down. He rolls out on the floor. I go to get him. I get him in the back of the head. He does it himself. He runs his head into the ring post where it rings like a gong. Boom. He then turns around, blood's now really flowing. He says, the table. I grab him in the back of the head, head first through the table. He does a headstand with his head through the table and his body up in the air. People start to throw stuff. And, I mean, Tullahoma's a wild crowd. They still believe that. It's a great atmosphere in this old building. They've turned into a wrestling arena. And as I'm beating on him, I see Misty sitting about three rows up in the bleachers, crying. I mean, she's crying. So we get to the back, they come pay me. They said, you better get out of here. You know, got heat. So I'd send word together. We get in the car. She said, why? Why would you beat that old man up that like that? I said, first of all, don't let him hear you call him an old man. I said, second of all, I was fighting for my life. He did all that stuff to himself. That's Gypsy Joe.
They don't make them like that no more, folks. I'm telling you.
No, they never will.
That's awesome. And Joe was one of a kind. That's for sure. And if a lot of people don't remember that, you know, Joe had a career before the Gypsy Joe gimmick. G Madrid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
G Madrid, the Blue Infernos, Aztec Joe, Chief Tuna, Pepe Figueroa. working on in New York. He started wrestling in the late 40s.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, he was everywhere.
Think about that minute. Think about the late 40s. Yeah. And he wrestled to about 2011.
It's crazy. All right, let's go now to 1989. May 1989, and we left off, and there with Continental, and there's some changes in talent going on. We got some bigger names starting to come in. Bill Dundee's the booker, and they're starting to, you know, do a little stuff here. But first off, we have a big departure to lead off with, as the Party Boys, Party Patrol, Johnny and Davey Rich have left and have gone to work for the NWA, and they left as the Continental Tag Team Champions, so they had to do a fictitious title change.
Yeah, okay, everybody listening here now. Because I see it reported in the title switches, they never lost them to Chono and Mike Davis. Like you said, they did the Phantom Switch. They did lose a match in Knoxville on a DQ, which was their last night. And I don't know why. I don't know if they had given notice. I don't know. I'd have to ask Johnny or Davey about that. But they did lose a DQ, but that's what they consider in the title histories as the title switch, but that's what it was. Not
they
a switch.
They share like clips on television.
No, they just said that, you know, they lost in Knoxville, which they did, so they weren't lying.
Yeah, because you know the famous one of that one is the there's a Rock and Roll Express, Manny Fernandez, Rick Rude, you know, the fake NWA World Tag Title change.
Where they show the dark match from Columbia and say it happened in Tacoma, Washington.
Yeah, so that's the famous one. But the thing about this change, though, is did they know what they were about to get into with Chono when they decided to do that?
I don't know. I would not think they would, because I don't think they would have picked them. I think it would have been, you know, somebody else.
What happened was Masahiro Chono's visa ran out. He had to go back to Japan.
Yeah. And then they did the fictitious switch in Murphy, North Carolina, of Jimmy Golden and the Mongolian Stomper beating Mike Davis and Mr. Chono. Stomper had not been on Continental or Southeastern TV in the Alabama market in 7 or 8 years.
Since 83, so it was about six.
Okay. So, yes, it was okay. And Jimmy Golden had not been on there for over a year. And all of a sudden, they're the new champions. Now, that I don't know if that was announced on the Alabama end, because the Stomper never worked on the Alabama end. When it was on the Alabama end, it was Jimmy Golden and the Stormtrooper, because Archie was a full-time deputy sheriff and could not leave Knoxville. He had to be back at work in the morning.
Yep. And that's an interesting team. And Ron Wright was their manager.
Yeah.
So you had, I mean, this seemed like it was basically a Knoxville type thing, but you know, again, Alabama really didn't play that up.
By then, Knoxville was the big money town. Montgomery was the second town. Birmingham had just died. Chattanooga was dying a fast death because Crockett had moved in there. Johnson City had been taken over by Crockett, but Knoxville was still the stronghold and it was still drawing money.
Yeah. Now, another new entry into the area and a, favorite of Between the Sheets, became pretty much a Between the Sheets Hall of Famer. Don the Stomper Harris is in here, fuming Wendell Cooley.
Yeah. Dundee knew him and his brother from when they started in, Memphis 2 years earlier, as you know, Ron and Don Harris, the Bruise Brothers, and their blonde hair and pink trunks. You know, if you've only seen them as, you know, the long-haired, tattooed, biker-looking Harris brothers, you need to go back and find them early Memphis days when Sawyer Brown was their manager, the band Sawyer Brown, and they had pink trunks and denim jackets and pink boots. Yeah.
Total babyface look, you know, that era of babyface look.
And here he is as a singles heel. Why wasn't Ron here with him? You know?
Here is the folklore of that story. And I don't know. Part of me wants to believe this story.
Oh, boy.
I've heard this story from a few people. Ricky Morton has said to me many times that, but he always says this is what was said. So I don't know who said it to Ricky, so I don't know. But supposedly Don Harris, Don was here, Ron Harris, was undercover in Florida working a case to bust a drug cartel.
Okay.
So I don't know. We'll just stick with that.
It's always struck me as weird. And yeah. Don, Continental wasn't the only place that Don worked as a singles at this time. I think he was in Memphis as a singles either right before or right after this. And yeah, like Ron disappeared and he just shows back up, you know, a little bit later on. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting.
And Dundee was trying to recreate a Mongolian Stomper. And that's why it was Don the Stomper Harris. And if you watch, he actually wore the Stomper's boots.
That's right.
And, you know, they were trying to recreate or make a new Stomper. And, you know, he was put with Wendell Cooley, and they put a lot of time into Harris doing that deal where he had spray painted Wendell's streak down Wendell's head, you know, through his hair, a white streak, and they called him Polecat Cooley and, you know, all that stuff. I don't think he was seasoned enough to be in that spot yet.
Polecat Cooley. I vaguely remember that. I'm watching that years ago. That's awesome because, of course, Wendell's name was Wildcat. So I love that. Polecat Cooley. Well, Chono's gone, so Mike Davis is a new tag partner. And they bring in Lou Fabiano to be his partner. And Lou also worked in Memphis a little bit later on from this. But Lou had a short cup of coffee here. But Lou's...
Let's see here. He came in around May, and he stayed the whole summer. I guess he left maybe in August.
A couple months. Then he went to Memphis.
Yeah. And if you remember right, he came from New York, and there was a young guy that came from California named Louis Spicoli.
They were the Sicilians.
They were the Sicilians. And I don't know how Lou got booked, and Lou's a nice, nice man. You know, just he was just a nice guy. And Louis Spicoli at this time, and I didn't know Louis after this. I just knew him from being around the ring. He was always a nice guy. But, you know, Louis had sent a tape from California trying to get booked and had called a couple times. And it was kind of like the Sting and Warrior deal in Memphis where, you know, Dundee said, look, this is a long way from home. You got X amount of dollar guaranteed each night, which wasn't a lot of money. I think Continental was $50 or $75 minimum. You know, Knoxville, of course, was more. Montgomery was more. But they offered you're going to wrestle six nights a week. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of places left for the young guys to go and learn their craft. And Spicoli told Dundee, I'll come. And he packed up and drove to Birmingham. And, you know, he stuck around, but he got to work with a lot of great guys. He got to work with Ricky Morton and Dundee and Adrian Street and all these guys at this time. So he got a real education in Southern pro wrestling.
Yeah, because he had worked, he'd done WWF work underneath. I mean, he had been places, of course, worked California and all the groups out there.
But just never wrestled full time.
Yeah, he was, you know, just, well, not in any type of prominent role other than California groups. You know, he would get better matches.
Yeah, but they were running, I guess, you know, weekends, maybe a weekday shot here or there, where Continental ran 6 days a week.
This is first territory, as you would say. Mm. And, you know, there's a one match here where he teamed with Tom Pritchard to face the Fantastics in Dothan on May 20th. And the Fantastics at this time were Bobby and Jackie Fulton.
Not in May. In May, it was Bobby and Tommy.
Okay.
Yeah. Tommy was there for May. They came in together, and Jackie had just started a couple weeks earlier. And this truly is the beginning of Jackie's career.
Yeah.
Because he had wrestled in Ohio on some outlaw shows a few times, and Bobby had called in, asked Dundee, could you give him a job? And he did. And this is where he jumped in with both feet and got wet.
And Bobby and Tommy didn't last long here.
No, Bobby stayed a little longer because he stayed and worked. He did tag with Jackie in June, in July a little bit.
Moved on to Memphis.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tommy was just,
but
Tommy was basically working Japan and some shots here and there in the U.S., but it was mainly just Japan for him.
Yeah, and he had a job in Pensacola working for Coke.
There you go.
Working at the Coca-Cola plant.
There you go. But the big, big debut here on in this time period, Jim Cornette, Beautiful Bobby Eaton, Sweet Stan Lane, The Midnight Express. And they're working Jimmy Golden and the Stormtrooper in Dothan. And then in Knoxville on May 26th, working Golden and the Stomper.
And in Johnson City, Golden and Stomper. This is when I realized, as I talked about on the last program, when Mike Jackson was getting wins on TV, I realized then something's different.
Yeah.
You know, but this is the moment, this night in Johnson City, when I realized Continental's in trouble. Because if you look, and I'm trying to get this thing to load up here with the card, Ricky Morton against Tom Pritchard. Ricky Morton's right off Crockett TV. Fantastics against the Stormtrooper and El Lobo. Cornette and the Midnight Express with Ron Wright, the biggest name in East Tennessee. Jimmy Golden and Stomper. Stomper being the second greatest heel East Tennessee ever saw. Plus Wendell Cooley and Don Harris. Adrian Street and Bill with Mike Davis and Lou Fabiano. This was a loaded card with guys off of Crockett's TV plus weeks of them pushing these three towns or four towns, over how many it was, Cornette came into. Cornette interviews for Continental TV talking about Ron Wright and how his varicose veins look like a map of the Tri-Cities, how scars on his head look like a map of East Kentucky, how he may be the greatest talker of all time, and he might be the greatest manager of East Tennessee, but Midnight Express is bigger. You know, great, great stuff. And it only drew about 600-700 people. Where at the same time, Rock and Roll Midnight and Fantastics had been wrestling at Freedom Hall, and they were on a heck of a run with Crockett running there once a month, selling out for three straight years. And they're over here at the rec center, and they didn't fill it up. And I knew they're in trouble because I really expected, you know, this place is going to be sold out. And it far from it.
Why do you think that was? Why do you think the fans weren't coming out?
The TV was not as strong as Crockett's TV. It had a great time slot. It was on the local ABC, which was a UHF channel. All you young guys listening, you had you had VHS channels 2 through 13. Then after 13, UHF, low-powered stations. And they just didn't get out there. They didn't cover like Crockett did on Channel 5. Plus, Crockett now has the main event. He has worldwide. He has the pro. He has Sunday night, Saturday night. He just, I think about this time, started the Power Hour on Friday night.
Like a month later. But still,
yeah.
There's four TV shows right now.
Yeah, and you have an hour of Continental, the local wrestling. Now it's beginning to see these are the local guys. These are the superstars. Times have changed. Cable TV has taken over. And also, there was no angle. If they could have just had one TV, could you imagine one TV were Cornette and the Midnighter there, and they came out and they, you know, wrestled Lou Fabiano and whoever, and Ron Wright and the Stomper and Jimmy Golden come out of the dressing room or out of the crowd and just beat them to death and leave them laying. The heat that it would have gotten. And, you know, and if they just could have had that one TV with not just, I mean, Jimmy did great interviews, send them in from Charlotte, but if they could have just had them there one time and to get that angle on TV where people could have seen it, I think a lot of people did not believe they were coming. Because here's the thing. People are starting to leave Continental. Johnny Davy Rich gone. Chono's gone. I'm trying to think if Danny Davis, is around the time. Okay, but he's getting close to when he's going. So they see people leaving. There's people advertised, but they've already given their notice and left, so they're not there when you go. And I think people really thought, well, their Fantastics aren't going to be there. Cornette's not going to be there. Midnight's going to. Now, they knew Ricky Morton was going to be there because he was already on TV and he was doing local interviews. So they knew he was there, but they didn't. I just really think they didn't believe that Cornette, because Cornette and Midnight had just been on TV for Crockett.
People didn't know that they had really left, probably.
Right. And they only left for a month because you remember they're back at the Clash of Champions from
Fort Bragg.
From the Fort Bragg, yes. So, and there's still people that said, well, you know, they advertised, they did not go to this day, still believe they were not there. You know? I was at the Great American Bash 87 in Charlotte in the football stadium. I saw the bash in Charlotte in the Coliseum. I saw, I don't know how many Crockett House shows in Johnson City, Knoxville, Bristol, you know, wherever. I was super fan. Anywhere I could go to the matches, I would go. But this card in Knoxville and Johnson City were two of the best live cards as a fan that I ever saw anywhere. And it's just a shame that none of it was videotaped. And it's a shame that there's still people that did not believe they showed up.
Sad. Sad, sad. But, yeah, they only did, you know, a couple of appearances. And
it was a favor to Dundee, who had started all of them's careers, you know, either in Memphis or Louisiana.
Yeah, he gave him, you know, he was the booker at Mid-South when Eaton and Condrey and Cornette were all put together. You know, of course, Lane, you know, was a different story, but still, there's a connection there.
Real fast here, is I'm got my notes up here. I'm going through them. I just saw the one that we had talked about, Chono and the Equalizer. I just saw Mick Foley post a couple of days ago that the man that was the Equalizer in Continental, he passed away this week.
And who was that?
I can't remember. It's on Mick's Twitter. I saw him post a picture. But it was the guy that wrestled on TV for Continental as the Equalizer. Okay. And he passed this week. He was an Alabama guy. And him and Mick were buddies, and they'd kept up with each other all these years, which that's the kind of guy Mick is. Mick's a great guy, you know. But Mick had put that on his Twitter that he had passed away.
Yeah, Mick, going left and right. All right, June comes along, and, you know, everything's pretty much holding steady. But a new entry comes in to the area, Terrence Garvin. Our good friend Terry Sims, and boy, he change it.
My friend of many years, Terry Garvin, one of my favorite people.
Boy, does he change the dynamic of this territory, because there was nobody like him. Adrian Street was Adrian Street, but there was nobody like Terrence Garvin.
Terry was, you know, it was an instant program with those two.
Absolutely.
But Terry, he didn't try to be Adrian. He was the beauty. He didn't try to be exotic Adrian. That's what made it work. That's what made it work with Hustler Rip Rogers. Hustler Rip tried to be Hustler Rip. He was Hustler Rip. He didn't try to be Adrian. So the same thing worked with Terry. Same kind of gimmick to an extent, but Terry had enough originality in it, enough charisma in it. You know, and just the interviews alone between these two, where Adrian would call Terry Garvin Tom Pritchard's ugly sister. You know, and Terry would say, if I wasn't such a gentleman, I would scratch your eyes out. You know, he shows up with this pink mat to put it on the ring. And he just interviews with the Beast. And the Beast comes with him at first, and then Guling leaves and comes back. We'll get to that. But they have this pink mat. And I was one of the guys that put the pink mat on the ring around here. I am 14 years old, getting cussed out. You could still smoke at the wrestling matches. People are flicking cigarettes at us. Calling us every kind of name you could imagine for putting his pink mat on the ring.
I'm pretty sure that the gay slurs were flying fast and furious.
Oh, yeah. And I'm scared to death. I'm thinking, what in the world? Yeah, I'm just doing what Mr. West told me to do. I met Terry then when I was a kid, and just a great guy. And I keep up with Terry. Unfortunately, most of the time when me and Terry talk now, it's because somebody has passed away that we knew. But lost contact with him. That's one of the great things about social media. You know, we've all found each other. Terry's did my show, and I've did his show, and just a great guy. And he was not afraid to do that gimmick.
Oh, no. No, he was not. You could tell he was committed. He loved it.
When you would see him come in the building and his hair would be, you know, perfect, and he would be in this bright pink warm-up suit with a purse over his wrist and just prancing through there. I'm talking about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There's nobody in there, you know, other than us to help put the ring up and whatnot. You know, and you're thinking, man, look at this freaking guy, you know. And he had heat, and he was not afraid to get heat. He was not afraid to go after it where he, you know, he was one of them guys, I want the people to come after me.
You don't get much of that, you know, anymore. I mean, that's an old school trait that, yeah, that's kind of been lost over the years.
You would not even be able to show his matches on television now with the slurs that were yelled at him and his Beast. They would have to just be silent films playing on television because the crowds were so loud screaming at him.
Well, they couldn't even do that gimmick today because it would be insensitive towards gays. It's not politically correct. You know, you can't do that.
Right.
Even though they really, I mean, that's the thing, though. He was never perceived as gay. You know, it was the, you know what's going on. You know, it's that read between the lines deal. You know, that's why you just couldn't do that today without being in trouble. But yeah, we're gonna talk more about him because he's just now coming in, and there's a lot of things about to come up.
The videos that they shot at him at the hair salon. And I don't know if you know this, Chris. You know, how Terry got into wrestling?
Wasn't he Lawler's stylist? Didn't he cut long?
No, he was the stylist to the stars.
They would play the video. See, where I first saw that video was in Memphis, on Memphis Television, when he was there.
Yeah. And he did Reba McEntire's hair, Winona Judd's hair, George Jones's hair. He did men and women's. He was the hairstylist to all the big stars of the 80s, and he had a successful business, you know, doing that, because he didn't take anybody off the street. You had to be somebody for Terry Sims to do your hair. And Bill Dundee somehow got an appointment with him to get his hair dyed and cut. And Terry said, you know, you don't know me, and this is probably crazy, but I always wanted to be a wrestler. And they got to talking, and Dundee trained him and got him in the business.
Yeah. The video from Memphis where it shows him in the salon and stuff like that. That's just great stuff.
Holding the poodle.
Great stuff. June 23rd in Knoxville, Tom Pritchard regains the CW heavyweight title, beating Wendell Cooley. And more on that, what happens with that title in a second. Steel cage match, the Stomper and Golden over the new Rock and Roll Express, Ricky and Todd Morton. And this is one of the rare times in this era that Ricky and Todd were a tag team.
Well, now, they worked a lot of spot shows together.
Well, I'm talking about, you know, I mean, I think mainly this year was just here in Memphis, because they did go to Memphis together. And
yeah.
And, of course, they went to NWA in January. With, I mean, Ricky and Robert reunited, but
went back, right? But yeah, Ricky and Todd had matches on TV, but Ricky was more tied into his deal with Tom Pritchard during this. But they would work a lot of the spot shows where it would be, you know, Ricky and Todd working with either Tom and somebody, or Golden and Stomper, or Fabiano and Mike Davis, because they were teaching Todd. Todd was only had a year in the business. Him and Jackie Fulton and Terry Sims, you know, all these guys, they're getting, and Louis Spicoli, they're getting an education from big name stars that drew a lot of money, and they're under the learning tree in Continental with them.
Yep. And Ricky and Todd was a fun little team. From what I have seen of them together, like in Memphis, they were good together.
Yeah, I used them in 2003. I had them
and
together.
That was a totally different Todd Morton in that era.
Yeah, that was. And but I had them together in the summer of 2003. I had them wrestle with me in KC, and fun, easy. I thank the world of Todd. Anybody that's read my book or knows me knows Ricky Morton's part of my family. He lives right here close by, and I talk to him all the time and go down to his school. And for 20 years, we've been buds. Longer than that, but yeah.
Yeah, so. Todd had that career renaissance in the early 2000s with IWA Mid-South, you know, with Bull Payne and Mitch Ryder and all that crew.
If Todd would have just been 4 or 5 inches taller, he would have got a break, a bigger. I mean, he did well for himself, but he would have got a bigger break. Yeah.
He's a good, real good talent, real good talent. All right.
That card is also the last night as Dundee is the booker, and Ricky's last night in Continental.
Yeah, because Dundee now goes back to work with Jarrett, and Morton goes to work with Jarrett too. Ricky goes to work with Jarrett at that time. But yeah, Dundee leaves his booker, and he's replaced by the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud.
Who we'll talk about in a second. But now in July, and now I can return to my more detailed notes, because now we get to stuff that I've seen in recent years. So on July 3rd in Birmingham at the Fairgrounds, we have, I think this may have been the first TV match between Terrence Garvin and Adrian Street. And Garvin hands Laura the Ring Girl his robe and then slaps her right in the face. She dropped it. And Tom Pritchard, on commentary, said that she deserved it and she gets it every night anyway. Imagine that today, folks. But
And Terry did not want to do that.
I'm pretty sure he didn't.
Laura was not a wrestler, and you know, Terry. And I've heard Terry talk about it a couple times on his podcast. He did not want to do it, but you want to keep a job, you do what you're told.
Yep.
You know, and Laura's just a sweetheart of a lady, just a sweetheart.
Well, this wasn't the only female abuse in this match, as Garvin beats Street up. I mean, beats him pretty bad. Then the heels run out and attack Street, handcuff him to the rope. And then Garvin destroys Miss Linda until all the baby faces run out. And then Garvin cuts a promo afterwards. Street runs him off and cuts an angry promo himself. And yeah, this is, I love this version of Adrian Street, the baby face version. If you watch Adrian Street this time, he was not really heavy on the makeup. I mean, he was like basically the real Adrian Street here.
Yeah, he did a little deal there with him and Dundee teaming with Chono against Chono and Davis first, and then just Fabiano, Mike Davis, and whoever else. Now he's locked into a program, and you see the fire and the passion come out of him. You know, and you see this, and this Linda takes a beating from Terry Garvin that would never be allowed to be shown on television now. A man beating up a woman.
God, yeah.
I mean, this he gets her down and just punches her and kicks her and slaps her. I mean, just it's something like you would see on Cops. You know, it was just crazy. And did it ever get the heat? I mean, it accomplished what they wanted.
It was a great kickstart to their feud, that's for sure. All right, next we get a promo by the returning Robert Fuller and the incoming Primetime Brian Lee. And they're coming to Continental and talking about Rage in the Cage. Some more on that a little bit later.
Yeah. And this is the first, if you didn't live in Memphis, this was really your first time seeing Brian Lee. He'd been in Dallas and Memphis. But he is also introduced as a cousin.
Yep.
To Jimmy Golden and Robert Fuller and the new member of the Stud Stable. And this is Brian's first shot as being a top heel. You know, he had had a little bit of a babyface run, even champion in Memphis, and he teamed in Dallas a little bit with Robert, but this is his first time as getting that top push.
Yeah, and very green, but great look. I mean, that's one thing about Brian Lee in this era, and that's one reason why, you know, WCW tried to use him in 90 was he had such a great look. He looked like a million bucks, but just didn't have it at this time period. And got it a little bit later, but it was, you know, totally different Primetime Brian Lee by then. Also in the area now, Loverboy Dennis Condrey is here as a babyface.
And boy, didn't it hit the fame. He's a babyface
at this moment. working Mike Davis. Davis jumps him at the bell, works him over. Condrey starts beating him up. Mike Davis uses a chain. Condrey blocks it. Then jacks his jaw with a chain to win. Then cuts a big promo on Tom Pritchard, starting up their little feud.
And how he's back in Alabama and how he'd run roughshod all over the country and you know, what he had done. And you know, he's an Alabama boy. It was a homecoming. And Dennis had great runs.
You've never seen Dennis Condrey, Randy Rose in Alabama in 80, 81, 82.
Or Condrey and Phil Hickerson in Tennessee and Knoxville end and Memphis end. You know, they what a team. And Cornette will tell you his favorite team, one of his favorite teams was Condrey and Phil Hickerson managed by Ron Wright.
Great team.
And, you know, it was kind of one of those deals like with the Midnight. Condrey's too big of a star to be here, kind of.
Yeah, and he's also at this time known as the Lethal Weapon, Dennis Condrey. So he's on his own deal, solo, and he's about to get a real big push. And, yeah, he's starting a feud with Tom Pritchard, who's the champion. Go ahead.
Tom had been around there for a while, and he needed a new opponent.
Now, Terrence Garvin has another match on this tapings against a guy named Johnny Gilbert, and he beats him up. And then Garvin cuts a promo afterwards saying that women are only around to give birth, so men wouldn't have to go through the pain.
I forgot that. I got to pull this out and watch some of this stuff here. I've got all these TVs off. And Garvin was a natural, you know, and I think a lot of that had to do, you know, he's doing hair all day. Well, while he's doing people's hair, he's got to talk to them. He's got to entertain them while they're sitting there. Yeah. And I think a lot of this stuff and these characters and these interviews that he came up with, you know, he just went back and he used a lot of lines and a lot of stuff that he heard from country music singers. He used a lot of their material. So it was, I'm sure if they're watching, they got a pop out of it. You know, but he wasn't using the same old wrestling lines. You know, but he was still using great lines, great one-liners.
Nah.
You know, and it was just, he was a fresh of breath air to Continental.
Now, the main event of this thing is a 2 out of 3 falls match between the New Rock and Roll Express against Jimmy Golden and Jerry Stubbs with the hairpiece.
This one's Ricky's last night. This is where they start to turn with Stubbs.
Stubbs is, of course, wearing his hairpiece. And Stubbs
It's a weave. It's not a pair of peaches. Yeah, it's a weave.
Stubbs drops the ball after the Studstead interference backfire. He tries fighting him, but eats a spike pile driver, loaded boot, and another spike pile driver on the steel chair. They could continue to beat the hell out of him until the Mortons run back in. And, yep, Jerry Stubbs back as a babyface again.
And without the mask.
Without the mask. A rarity.
Which was very rare, because it usually, once he made that switch, you know, he went from Clark Kent to Superman, he put that mask on. And, you know, I think this is his only babyface run in this territory without a mask.
It is.
You know.
It is.
And but, you know, here's the thing. Jerry Stubbs, one of my favorites in the ring and out. Jimmy Golden, same way. But it was kind of like the old Dutch Golden thing a year earlier when they sold the territory. Robert was rehashing what they've already seen. Here we had went from Kerry Von Erich, a fresh face, Black Bart, Terry Gordy, you know, the Mortons, Midnight, all these new faces that people had not seen, and now we're kind of back to what we had just went through with for a decade.
And that's about to be more of that. As on July 14th at the Civic Coliseum in Knoxville, the Southern Boys are back. Steve Armstrong and Tracy Smothers, and they're working with Robert Fuller and Primetime Brian Lee, restarting that feud up. So here we go again, the Fullers and the Armstrongs.
And why? Here's the thing I do not. Well, I kind of get it and I kind of don't. But they were advertised in all the towns as a mystery team. The Stud Stable versus a mystery team. I still have the programs from this week that I sold, and that's what it's listed to, you know. Why not just say Steve and Tracy? Because they hadn't been around there for a decade. They had a year run and went away and came back. So they still were a fresh team and had just had that break. So we're over. So why not say, hey, you know, the Southern Boys are coming back and show some videos of them.
Yeah, and also the Southern Boys has pretty much have been broken up. They had worked in Japan, you know, went to New Japan and worked there for a bit. Yeah. And then Tracy went back to Memphis and worked with John Paul as the Mason-Dixon connection.
Mason-Dixon, that's right.
Now they, you know, Tracy and Steve reunites here. And this is the beginning of their great run together. But, yeah.
And they were having very good matches with Fuller and Lee. You know, and it was something new because they didn't – The Southern Boys didn't work with Fuller and Lee before, so you do have a new program. You know, I understand why they said a mystery team, because they wanted, well, who is it? Could it be this? Could it be that? Could it be? But I think in the long run, it would have been better just to do the old Memphis deal, show the music videos of them coming back, get the people ready. That way, when you see them, you know, you're ready for them.
Yeah, pop the house.
Yeah.
Well, July 22nd in Dothan, Dennis Condrey defeats Tom Pritchard to win the CWF heavyweight title. But that's not the big story here, as after the match, he attacks Wendell Cooley and turns heel. And tell everybody how that went down.
Well, now, that was on the heel turn actually came in the Rage in the Cage.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And it was in Huntsville.
There we go.
First match of the night, they have Condrey and Tom Pritchard, and Dennis comes out, and Huntsville's Dennis's hometown. He beats Dr. Tom. Place goes crazy. He does his interview that I'm here. I'm a stay. I'm a new man. Just like I've been telling you, this is your belt, our belt, you know, just the ultimate babyface match. Then in the dark match where they had been doing the Raging Cage match, which was it was a one ring war games, and you handcuffed your there was handcuffs all around the ring where you could handcuff your opponent. The winning team, the last man on the winning team, got the key and he could unlock his partners, and they got 5 minutes to beat on the guys who were handcuffed. So Andre beats, I think it was Brian Lee. And as they give him the key, Sylvia jumps up on the ring table, ring announcer's table, with a microphone, and says she's got a blue money pouch full of money. I'll give you $10,000 for the key. And he takes it over to people's, no. And he takes the money, and he gives the key to Sylvia. She goes in, unlocks the heels. They beat the baby faces, leave them a bloody mess. They then go in the dressing room with Ron West, confronts him. He calls Ron West a stooge. I'm here about the money. The people mean nothing to me. So in 1 hour, he went from being the biggest baby face to homecoming to the most hated man in town.
And that's awesome.
It was great. It was great because he had some steam on him now, and he went he's a much better heel anyways. And now he's using the DDT, and they're doing it right. Not everybody on the card's using it. Dennis is hitting people with it, and they're getting carried out.
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of 1988 Crockett lately, and 87, 88. And I swear, on like one show, I saw like 5 guys using the DDT. And this is back then.
Hey, last year in Hazard, Kentucky, Jake Roberts is there. He made an appearance, and he's sitting ringside. In the first match, a guy uses the DDT with Jake sitting there.
And wasn't even a finish.
No, it was not a finish. It was. Yeah.
This is 87, 88. Yeah. And it wasn't a finish then either. It was a transition.
Oh. There's those moves that come along to where all of a sudden everybody sees it. I remember when I was a kid, where they throw the baby face on the floor, he comes up on the apron, the heel goes to him, he gives him the shoulder and the gut, then the sunset flip. It seemed like every match had that all of a sudden.
That happened a lot.
It came on. And then the DDT had come along. The suplex was a finish. The dropkick was a finish. All of a sudden, they're just high spots for everybody,
Oh, yeah. I mean, wrestling's a copycat game. Always has been, always will be. It's just...
But the problem with that is when you have a top guy using it and everybody uses it before him, what does it mean?
Exactly. All right. On the show, we had Terrence Garvin against Danny Davis. Garvin has his beast here on a chain. Now, this is not Mark Guling. This is a female beast. And who was this? Who would this have been?
It was a girl that drove to the matches in a hearse.
Oh my God.
And somebody said, we got to get this girl in the business. And she was terrible. Horrifying.
That's for sure. But anyway, Danny Davis got the sleeper on Garvin. Beast got involved, allowing Garvin to attack with his perfume can for the DQ. Garvin cuts promo afterwards and kisses Charlie Platt, which I'm sure he loved. No one saw Platt. Oh, I mean. All right. And then you have a CWF tag title match in this show, the Southern Boys against Fuller and Lee. Southern Boys at this time had won the belts, or they were awarded the belts as Stomper left.
Let's back up for a second. The Stomper didn't leave. The Stomper couldn't make the Alabama towns.
What I'm saying. He didn't work anymore.
Right. I'm trying to... When Fuller and Lee came in, they were advertised as the world tag team champions.
Coming in from,
world class. And they were advertised as the world class world tag team champions. And there was one of those first matches where they have no belts but are called the world champions because they'd already lost them in Dallas. And the... Dallas tape was showing on ESPN at this point in time. So people knew they had lost the belts. But Jimmy Golden does commentary. And he goes through this deal that me and the Stomper had a falling out, and I beat his brains out, and he's gone, and I'm going to have to find a partner to be the CWF Tag Team Champions with. And then the next week, they say the Southern Boys won the belts. So they did not follow that. And I guess somebody finally told them, hey, World Class shows here. We know you don't have the belts. So they dropped the world tag title.
And you see, all right, so this, and this is three straight Phantom title changes for this title. Think about that, folks. Three straight changes like that. Crazy. Well, August 11th in Knoxville, we see the return of Doug Furness in the Tennessee heavyweight title, defending against Tom Pritchard. And, of course, DeCondre and Wendell Cooley, the CWF heavyweight title, and a Texas Deathmatch main event where Robert Fuller, Jimmy Golden, and Brian Lee faced the Southern Boys and a mystery partner who turned out to be
Jerry Stubbs, who the people already knew was going to be Jerry Stubbs from where they did the turn. And Stubbs even come out and did an interview and said, I'm going to ask the Southern Boys if I can be their partner.
Yes.
So this, Mick Foley's first book is we'll be getting to Mick here in a minute. I love Robert Fuller to death. I thank the world of him. Robert's came up and worked for me in my promotion. I've known Robert, and I've seen him at the Mobile reunion and other places and stuff. But read Mick Foley's, go back and read his first book about Continental, because he really lays out, you know, where Robert's mind was at this time. And I'm not judging anybody. I'm just, you know, I'm just saying, you know, like where he told Mick, hey, send the tape in before you get here. So Mick sent in the Helter Skelter video from World Class. As Mick gets to his apartment, Robert says, hey, Mick, let's go down to the post office and see if your tape got here. He went down there to get it. So they start showing the tape. On the first time that Mick's video shows is the same week that he wrestles the first time, rather than having it play for a few weeks before he got there. So there's just a lot of confusion at this point in time. There is, around this point in time, and I have this on YouTube, and it did not play in every market, and it did not play here. It's a sit-down interview with Robert Fuller interviewing Linda and Adrian Street in the dressing room. And my copy comes off of Columbus TV.
Columbus, Mississippi.
It aired there, and I don't know where else, but it did not air in East Tennessee. Because I had never seen it until I got this Columbus version of these TVs. And he starts asking him, you know, if he's gay. And the Columbus station kind of beeps it out and edits it. I mean, it's up on YouTube. You can watch it and see where the edits are at. So, I don't know. But they were setting up, they were setting up the match with Adrian and Terry, where if Adrian won, they were setting up a tag match, a mixed tag to come back in the singles later tonight. Whichever side won, the girl would be the referee for the singles match between Adrian and Terry. And he doesn't do very much to get the match over. He just keeps asking Adrian, are you bent? No. You little bent? Are you touched? You know, and Adrian goes into, well, you know, me and Linda's a couple. I mean, it's the strangest thing for this time and place to be on a wrestling show. And it, like I said, it did not make every market. Just a lot of confusion going on at this time.
Crazy. Again, this is stuff that would not even come close to airing today. And it didn't even air back then in some markets.
Right. Right. Knoxville and Johnson City wasn't no part of it.
God. Wow. That's crazy. All right, August 13th in Montgomery, We have a TV taping here. Dennis Conger against Todd Moore. Conger, of course, beats Todd. Todd puts a fight in, but Conger rips up Cooley in a promo afterwards, saying he's going to drive him to commit suicide. Against
another subject you would not talk about
now. And then they should have closed him beating Dr. Tom. Dr. Tom comes out, yells at Conger, leaning into Dr. Tom against Keith Hart, not the Calgary version of Keith Hart. And then Dot beats him up, and he demands Conger come out to face him. Conger doesn't, so he beats up Hart. Conger then runs out, KOs Dot with something, DDT'd him on a steel chair, busting him wide open. And Buddy, he busted him wide open. He bled a lot here.
As they load him on the stretcher, it's all the way down to his knees, where it's ran down his body. It's so much. And that's Tom's farewell to Continental.
Yeah, because he was supposed to go to the NWA. Well, no. Okay. Now, I wouldn't say supposed, but the rumors had been there for months.
He went to Japan. Went to
Japan instead, but the rumors had been there for many months.
Oh, yeah. The rumor that he was going to be part of the Midnight Express in 87.
He was supposed to debut in May 89. We did that in Between the Sheets, him and Buddy Landell. We're going to debut on the same tape against a tag team. That didn't happen. In this time period, he's supposed to go to NWA. I thought Dr. Tom would have been a natural fit in that NWA at that time period.
I do, too. And Tom says most of the rumors were never true.
Got. I wonder who was putting them out.
I don't know, because he was happy where he was at. He was making a pretty good living up until, 89, when it really started going down. He was going to Japan some. The plan here was he was going to be away. He was going to Japan, and then he was going to come back and go to Houston to stay a little bit with his parents and see them, because they were getting older. He had not seen them, since he left in 77, left Houston. He had been working the territory since, and he was going to stay with them for a couple months just to visit with them. And then he was going to come back for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And then they were going to figure out and go from there. Well, you'll find out why that didn't happen coming up here in a few minutes.
Also on August 13th, we have a mixed tag match between Exotic Adrian Street and Miss Linda against Beauty and the Beast.
It is horrible.
Adrian Street, I said in my little report here, was painted up like a glam Papa Shango here.
He was. Here's the thing. Linda is a great wrestler. I saw Linda with Debbie Combs. I saw Linda with Mad Maxine. I saw Linda with Candy Devine. I saw Linda with the Greek girl that was around Memphis Continental in Kansas City. Oh man, Montagas,
the one that's married.
Yeah. Right. And, she never disappointed as a wrestler. But, you have to have somebody to work with. And this girl was not. And Linda tries in this match. Linda tries so hard to have a match with her. And if you watch the tape of this, a DVD of this, most of the match, they keep going to canned crowd reaction.
Yeah, yes. This is a rare clipped match on television.
And finally, you see Adrian Street. I think he either pushed her down, tripped her, sucker punched her, something. And he tells Linda, hook her, hold her. And they get the three count and go.
I mean, what I mean by rare clip, I mean, you would get matches that are clipped for commercials. No. This was just a clipped match. It would go, parts of the match would go here and there. So,
But that wasn't the biggest match Terry Garvin had on this show, as he worked Todd Morton in a match. Garvin KO'd him in a perfume can to win. And Street and Linda comes out for a promo. They show clips for you. Todd offers his assistance to Street. And this is the beginning of the Adrian Street-Todd Morton relationship.
Yeah. And this was great for Todd because now he has a mentor. I mean, he had one with Dundee. Now he's got another guy that's been around the world and drew money that can help him in Adrian Street and Linda. You know, and they kind of took Todd under their wing and helped him along the way.
All right. We get a Continental CWF Heavyweight title match. Condrey against Danny Davis.
They did the DDT, really fun match.
Condrey goes to the floor and just immediately attacks Burrhead Jones, who was the timekeeper at ringside, pissed off Wendell Cooley. Then he DDT Danny Davis on the concrete.
Who's now just like Tom Pritchard, pouring blood.
Cooley goes check on him, and
Davis won't stop. He won't quit. He keeps beating on him. He tries to roll back in the ring, and Wendell pulls him out and holds him down and throws him down.
DDT'd him again. He DDT'd him twice on the floor, and then Cooley of course pulls him down, and Condrey celebrates heavily in the ring afterwards, saying, "This is what happens when you try to take my title." Cooley comes out next, you know, talking about what just happened. And Davis, you know, thanks Cooley for, you know, saving his life, even though he calls him the match.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's kind of like a real emotion. Yeah, you screwed me the title, but you saved my life. You know, I like that joke there.
And say goodbye coming up very soon after that with Danny Davis.
Now, also, because...
He's advertised in towns, but Danny's right after this, he's gone.
Also in this taping is a name that pops back up from the dead as Robert Fuller beats the Continental Cat.
Yeah.
What was the story here?
I don't know. He just kills him, puts his foot on him, 1, 2, 3. I don't even know who was in the outfit. I don't know. I guess he heard about the cat and he liked it. And he wanted to beat the cat to get over.
Amazing. All right, August 25th in Knoxville. This is the card we have. Todd Morton over Keith Hart. The Beast battled Miss Linda to a no contest.
Which went about 35 seconds.
Terrence Garvin over Adrian Street. Wendell Cooley over Mike Davis. Condrey retains CW Heavyweight title over Danny Davis. And in a match where... if you didn't think stipulations were enough, Texas Bull Rope, Indian Strap, and Chain Match, Southern Boys and Jerry Stubbs over Fuller, Golden, and Lee by count out. So not even a clean finish.
And blood, more blood, and even more blood in the last three matches.
And I'm pretty...
It's you know, all the stipulation matches now are just... their guys are bleeding like crazy. Now, I think this card, let me look at my notes here and I'm going to have to dance around a little bit of this something here because I don't want to get in the middle of a family dispute.
Oh, boy.
It was either that one or... the one of the September cards
in Knoxville.
In Knoxville, that Ron Fuller shows up. The contract for the building is still in his name.
On the 22nd of September. That's when he worked. Okay, let me look. Which is a funny match.
Okay, that's it.
We'll talk about that in a second. Then we'll wait till we get to that.
Yeah. Oh, yes, because this is the dreaded week of the Robert Fuller, Kerry Von Erich story.
Yeah, so we'll get to that in just a second. All right, August 26th in Dothan, we have Dennis Condrey and Todd Morton. Morton's role here is to give a great fight to the heels, but Condrey puts Morton out with the DDT, Wendell's on commentary, Condrey baits him, grabs a steel chair, Cooley jumps in the ring, hits his bulldog, covers Dennis,
with Morton counting the pin, just get that visual pinfall, you know, over the champ. So good angle there. All right, Texas Tornado Steel Cage match. Exotic Agency Miss Linda versus Beauty and the Beast. And it's still the woman. Boy, was this an
interesting... And it's not gotten any better, Chris, I can tell you.
What an interesting match this was, to say the least. Garvin throws powder in the eye at the baby faces, you know, and that starts the match off. Streak makes a comeback. Him and Linda are starting to work him over until the original Beast is back, Mark Guline. And he attacks Todd Morton, who was there at ringside, with bolt cutters, jumps in the cage, and helps destroy the entire Street family. He bashes Linda's arm with the bolt cutters. Todd comes in. They beat the hell out of him with the cutters. Morton is just juicing like a maniac. And this is a wild angle.
And, you know, they did the powder and that stuff at the beginning because they realized after that match that had to be edited that we cannot have a match with this girl. And they just tried to limit her to choke, pull hair, pretty much hold Linda down in the corner until Linda was ready to make a comeback. It was wild. And this is the one where they broke her arm, right?
Yes, with the bolt cutters.
Yeah. They take the bolt cutters to her arm and, you know, just... And now you've got a big man in Mark Guline, you know, beating on Miss Linda. Miss Linda's now the toughest wrestler on the babyface side because it's taken two men to hold her down and beat her. You know, but, you know, I thought, really, they could have done the matches with Guline and Garvin against Linda in Street and let Linda beat up Terry. That would have, people would have went nuts for that.
That would have worked better.
You know, that would have been good. You know, I don't know where Guline was at for this short time. And he comes back to work with Terry, and they always had a good chemistry. They were good friends outside of the ring, you know, not just partners in the ring. They were good friends, and, you know, they trained together, starred together, and they got along. They were buds.
Yeah. Also on this show, CWF Tag Titles, Southern Boys against Golden and Lee, Roberts on commentary. Downtown Bruno's here now in the with the stud stable on crutches. So you got Bruno and Sylvia together. And they're at ringside, yep. And they're, you know, baiting Stevie to come out there and, you know, and go after them, which, you know, allows Smothers to get the hell beat out of him. And they built it up great because the fans were red hot for Smothers getting that top tag to Stevie. Stevie comes in, just going to town, four-way brawl. Robert's going crazy on commentary. Bruno gets nailed. Southern Boys go to finish off Lee. Ref gets bumped. Robert hits Stevie in the neck with Bruno's crutch. Lee gets the cover, wins the title. Southern Boys are pissed afterwards. So there's your title change. Golden and Lee.
Yep. The first title change.
Yeah, the first actual title change.
Since when? This the spring.
Title change since the Riches beat Anthony and Stubbs in February.
Gosh.
Yep. All right. September 1st in Knoxville. They're doing the Texas Tornado Steel Cage matches.
And here's the thing too. And we just come off the Rage in the Cage in August and July. You know, that was with 10 guys in there going at it. You know, it's kind of like the cage is not special now.
One thing
now.
You're going to notice and stuff that we're going to talk about is Robert Fuller definitely was loving the gimmicks at this time period.
Yeah.
And of course, Street and Linda versus Beauty and the Beast and Southern Boys and Stubbs and Stud Stable. So that was going around the horn. September 22nd in Knoxville. Who was the Baroness? Because that was a loose leaf town match with Linda.
Lee Peek in a stuffed ball.
Please tell us that story.
Well, Lee had been working on TV as the Baron, and as him and Jack Lord had been under hoods as different guys doing jobs on TV. Lee is a good hand, good guy. You know, and they didn't have another girl. So he pretty much worked in the same outfit. They just stuffed a bra and put it on him, and people thought it was a woman. I think he had a wig on coming out of the mask. And they had a great match.
Oh, that's great. And another match on this card, the next match after it, and you got to tell the story of this because I don't have the TV to build this one, but I got to know how it happened. Downtown Bruno against Butch Cassidy, the legendary Butch Cassidy from the last show.
And I got to say this, I have gotten so many tweets, Facebook messages, emails, even I had a guy come up to me, where was I at? Just the other day, somebody come up and told me, I know where it was at. We recorded on a Tuesday, the last program, when I told the Butch Cassidy story, that's what people were messaging me about. Well, an old-time Knoxville area guy named John Harvey, who wrestled as John Manson. He was one of the Russians in Continental at one point in time. Just a good guy. He passed away. And I keep hating to go back to saying that. That's happened to so many people here lately that, you know, I've been to more funerals here lately than I have wrestling matches. But we went to John's funeral, and a lot of the old boys was there. New Guinea Headhunter, Big Nick was there. Just all kinds of guys. And as this service was over, Tom Pittner was there. And I have not seen Tommy since Ron Wright's funeral. And Tommy comes straight over to me, and Exile had not been uploaded yet, so he had no idea that this story was on the last episode. And Tom comes up laughing, and he says, "I don't know why, but I just got to thinking about it. You remember that time that Butch beat up Teddy Scarborough in Lenoir City?" So I said, "Man, I just told that story on a podcast Tuesday night." Butch was, he'd moved back to Knoxville now because Littlebrook didn't have the touring midgets by this. And he had a couple of, his sons were wrestling, Karate Kid and, I can't think of the other kid's name. I can't remember. I knew the Karate Kid was the one I knew. But, you know, they had Bruno on TV, with heat on him. And Fuller did this in Memphis. You remember, he did it with the Karate Kid, where Bruno wrestled. He wrestled one of them first, and Fuller pile-drived him. And then he wrestled the Karate Kid on Memphis TV, and Fuller ended up pile-driving the Karate Kid on there. And they pretty much did that for Knoxville. Butch was a Knoxville guy. He was living at home, you know, just like all the other guys that they would book for just Knoxville. And so they did that, and Fuller ends up pile driving Butch. But see, here's the funny part about all of it. You know, all the other midgets that worked with Bruno, they did the funny stuff. They did, you know, the bite the butt and run around behind the referee and trip and fall and you kick out, and Butch comes to wrestle. And Bruno's not much bigger than Butch. And, you know, they do some comedy stuff in there, but, I mean, it just was Butch whipping Bruno all over the ring until Sylvie draws the ref, Fuller jumps in, pile drives him, and they give Bruno a cheap win with a lot of heat. You know, I don't believe in cheap heat. I mean, just to the people's eyes, you know, that what takes a low-down person to pile drive a midget. It was great. He got the heat on Bruno because they had to halfway drag him back to the dressing room after Butch had got done with him. You know, and people in Knoxville love Butch. And it was just something that it added to the card, and it was great.
And of course, we had Beauty and the Beast against Morton Street, Robert Fuller against Jerry Stubbs, Wendell Cooley against Bill Dundee.
And I don't know why Dundee's a heel. There was no explaining.
USA Heavyweight title, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud against Bill Tabb.
Who, at this point, he may have been just Bill Tabb if that's the way he was listed, but he was also wrestling as the Black Barbarian, the Black Assassin. And then, right here around these TVs, there was a six-man on TV with the Southern Boys and Stubbs wrestling Bill Tabb wearing a hockey mask, like a Lord Humongous type mask, and two other guys, and I don't remember who the other two guys were. I haven't watched it in a while, but Tracy Smothers drop kicks Bill Tabb. His hockey mask ends up in about the 14th row. And Charlie Platt is saying, I don't know who this is. I don't know who this
Phil
is.
Phil Sabb has been on Continental TV for years.
You're right. The people's yelling. We know that was you, Bill. You can hear him on the camera. We know that was you.
Yeah, if you've never seen Bill Tabb, he's kind of a guy that you know who he is. I mean, he's got a distinct look as far as physically. I mean, there's not, there's not a lot of guys built like he is. He's a big dude.
And he just rolls out of the ring and covers his face and never gets back up on the apron or nothing. But when he drop kicks him and the mask goes flying off, Charlie Platt bust out laughing.
And this is a tape show, folks. This is not live.
Yes. He is just laughing and laughing. And he's going, I don't know who it is. I can't see his face. You know, and then you can hear the rednecks in the front row. Hey, Bill, you ain't fooling nobody.
Oh, also on this show, CWF heavyweight title match. The Lethal Weapon, Dennis Carnegie, defending against the modern day warrior, Kerry Von Erich. And go ahead and tell the Robert Fuller, Kerry Von Erich story.
Okay. The night before, September 21st, Johnson City. Not as big a card here, but all the full Dundee wasn't there. I think it was Condry and Cooley, Southern Boys against Gold and whatnot. But the match is Robert Fuller against Kerry Von Erich. Now, I had knew part of this story from being a guy at ringside selling programs and a guy that helped put the ring up and, you know, whatnot. And it wasn't until years later talking to Terry Sims, who tells me the full story. And Terry has told this story a couple of times on his podcast, so I'm going to try to do it justice. But Terry telling it is a classic. So you might want to go try to see if you can find it, but I'm going to tell it the best I can tell from what I've heard from Terry and what I personally saw myself. Now, Terry says, you know, they're in Birmingham sitting by the pool on their day off on Wednesday. And Robert says, I should have never booked myself against Kerry Von Erich. He's going to hit me with that punch, or he's going to do this or going to do that. Yeah. It's like, I should have just had Dennis Wrestling everywhere. So they're talking and they're going on and this and that. And Robert told Kerry, and Terry said this was true, that Robert did not feel well when they left to come to Johnson City on Thursday. And he had sent word, they had different dressing rooms in Johnson City, different, you know, but he had sent word, please tell him, you know, just don't punch me in the stomach. Don't do the, you know, just listen and it'll be easy and he can get the claw on me and, you know, it'll be over with. Well, they lock up. And Kerry presses Robert over his head out of the lockup. I mean, straight away. No, hey, duck a punch. No, let me get over just a little bit. Or no, let me get your hair and we'll build this. You know, just lock up, snatch him. And he pushes him straight up over his head, you know, because Kerry, even after the accident, I mean, with one leg, he still was strong as a bull. Yeah.
He was jagged.
So up goes Kerry, up goes Robert. He then slams him. Now, Robert hits the ring so hard, he literally bounced back to his feet.
Oh, man.
As he comes to his feet, in one motion, he goes through the ropes, to the floor, to the dressing room. The ref starts counting. No Robert Fuller. Out comes running Terry Garvin, yelling at Kerry and distracting the ref and, you know, just killing time. No Robert Fuller. No Robert Fuller. Out comes Brian Lee, jumps in the ring, goes at Kerry, and they have the match. He slammed Rob so hard, he crapped himself. This is Terry telling me this. That's why he never came back. Now, we're out there going, what the heck just happened? We never saw Robert Fuller again the rest of the night.
Because the main event was Golden and Lee against Southern Boys.
Right. So, and Sylvia went out without, you know, without Robert. And he's, Terry, telling this story, he tells it much better than I do. But Terry says that Robert cussed all the way back to the hotel in Knoxville. They wrestled in Knoxville. He cussed all the way to Dothan the next day. He was so mad. And he wasn't mad at Kerry. He was mad at himself. I should have never did it. I knew it. I should have never booked myself with him.
So there we go, folks. Another instance of a wrestler shitting himself in the ring.
We should have Skyped Terry just to have him tell that story.
Well, so that Robert and Sid have in common. Another thing. Wow. Oh. And then they worked Dothan the next night. Kerry and Condry worked a Sibahua tie match. Kerry won by DQ. But the match here that's really interesting, unified heavyweight title. Wendell Cooley beating Jerry Lawler by DQ.
Yeah. Now, let's back up to Knoxville on September 22nd. And let me figure out how to tell this story without making anyone mad at me.
Hey, truth's the truth.
The truth is the truth. That's what Dundee tells me all the time. Hey, mate, if you tell the truth, they can only be mad at themselves. So, okay, let's tell it. I don't know what the story is. I only know bits and pieces of it because I don't ask anybody's personal business about anything. And I don't want nobody to ask me no personal business about any of my life. But there was a split with Ron Fuller and his wife. Rumor has it Dennis Condry caused it. Rumor has it Robert Fuller was told, don't you book him in Continental. He brings him to Continental. Ron Fuller owns the contract to the Coliseum. It never went to David Woods' name. Here's the thing. We'll go back to that, too. We talked about David Woods, and I don't know David Woods personally, and I never met him. I never talked to him. I've talked to his son twice about video footage. But he made horrible decisions in buying this wrestling company, and even bigger ones coming up that we'll get into about the TV. And he was a TV guy. But he never switched the contracts into his name or into his company's name.
That wasn't smart.
So Ron Fuller, who knows everybody at the building, because they have done business with him since 1975, walks up to the box office, takes all the money, leaves. There's no money for anybody else because the house just left. And legally, he had every right to it. Yeah. And I've heard that story from several people that was on that card that night. You know.
Yep.
This is a crazy business if y'all have not figured that out yet.
There was a lot of bad blood for years over that.
Yeah.
A lot of bad blood for years over that one. But why? My question here is, Lawler's working Dothan. Why isn't Lawler working Knoxville?
You know, I don't know.
Let me see if I can find where he was at that night. But yeah, I mean, that's just a weird one.
Maybe because, you know, they'd had him booked in February and he pulled out. Or Dundee canceled him or whatever the deal was, that they had built up that whole deal with him and Tom Pritchard. And he ended up going from that to Tom against Brad Armstrong. To actually ended up being Tom and Moondog's spot.
He may have been in Dallas. That's Friday. So he may have been in the auditorium.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Where he owned a piece of it and was getting paid as the main event guy, too. But, you know, Kerry was sent up here that. I'll say this. Kerry Drew here. Kerry Drew in Johnson City. He wasn't selling out, but the houses were up just to see Yvonne Eric.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he still had name value in places like he'd never been before. you know, like this. Yeah, definitely. Lawler was in Dallas. He worked, in fact, he worked Eric Embry in a lumberjack match for Unified Title, beat him that night in Dallas. So there you go. That's why he wasn't there.
Hey, all righty.
Yep.
Here's the thing, too, because I'm looking at Montgomery Civic Center, which was TV, but the TV's here now. They're trying now to tape a month at a time rather than 2 weeks at a time. That started, I think, in September, maybe August. They're holding people in there for 4 hours, and they're only booking 8 job guys, maybe. So if you look at the TVs at this time, you have an Avenger, you have the Panther, you have the Baron, you have the Executioners, you got the Russian Assassin, the Russian Enforcer. That Scrap Iron was the guy from Georgia. Worked for Jody Hamilton.
I can't remember his name. Well, who was Chief Little End?
Chief Little End was a guy from Georgia who also was the Avenger, who was also the Panther.
That was the worst name for an Indian wrestler, but Chief Little End.
It was Chief Little Lynn.
Oh, okay.
His last name is Lynn. Oh. Something. Nice guy. I seen him a couple of years ago in Dalton or Chatsworth or one of those towns. They never got his name right.
He said Little End.
Yeah. It's like Lance Jade when he first came to USWA and Power Pro. There was actually, he was announced as Lamp Shade a few times. Because people didn't understand his name when it was announced, and I would see it in the results. I actually have one of the magazines that has me versus Lampshade. That's why I've kept it all these years, just for that fact. That's but he was, they were just trying to cut cost. Fewer guys. I know Mick Foley would work.
This was his first taping.
And he would work the house shows almost twice every night to get extra money. They wouldn't have to pay him full price for a second guy, but he would get his full guarantee plus a little bit more for the next match.
Yeah, and so, yeah, you got guys coming in. Foley's here as Cactus Jack, of course, with the Stud Stable. Here's Scott Armstrong back as Dixie Dynamite. The first time that gimmick's been used. Now, people think of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. But no, Dixie Dynamite was born here, right here in this time period.
Yeah.
And of course, he's aligned with Steve and Tracy.
Steve had already had a song on one of the albums they sold at the matches. It was called Dixie Dynamite. And that was the song that they played in Smoky Mountain when he went to the ring. That's where the gimmick come from, was Steve's song. That's Steve Armstrong singing.
Wait, hey, the Armstrongs could sing, Brian, Stevie.
Yeah, that's good.
But yep. They're coming out here in full football attire as they are building to a football match with the Stud Stable. Now, the reason why they're doing this is, if you don't know, if you don't live in the South, on the third Saturday in October, it's University of Tennessee, University of Alabama. You know, that's the big...
Excuse me, those egg-sucking dogs from the University of Alabama.
That is a heated rivalry, and that's what they were playing up here. They were going to have a football match, playing off of that whole deal. And they were cutting promos about the whole Tennessee-Alabama deal, and that's what's going on.
And they did 2 matches at the tapings. One where the Southern boys are wearing the Crimson Tide, and one where they're wearing orange and white.
Smart.
They aired the orange and white in Tennessee. They aired the Alabama in Alabama. They did interviews with Golden and Fuller and Lee in Alabama, then in UT, and played them in the different markets. They knew their market. They knew their fan base. I don't know. Robert Fuller takes credit for coming up with the football match, and Bill Dundee takes credit for the football match. I tried it twice over the years.
What it is, what the match is about. Oh.
You have three men on the team. Two in the ring, one locked in a cage at ringside, or handcuffed to the bottom turnbuckle standing on the floor. Depending on if you want to build the cage or if anybody in Continental felt like driving the cage to the town. You know, the cages. So they have a football, and it is got a key taped onto the football that will unlock the cages or the handcuffs. And the idea was great on paper, that the fans would get involved, that, you know, the guys would be fighting over the ball would fly in the crowd would try to throw the ball away from the heels to the baby faces, kind of a keep away, then the heels are doing keep away. It's just one of those crazy Southern gimmicks. The first time I remember seeing it, and this is why I believe Dundee did come up with it, the first time I remember seeing it was Jonathan Boyd and not Rip Morgan, Sad Eyes, the other guy, Bigfoot. The real thing.
Yeah,
Bigfoot, yeah. Everybody called him Sad Eyes. With the Fabs. Jonathan Boyd is from New Zealand.
Rugby
so
match.
Was Sad Eyes.
The New Zealand rugby match? Yeah.
Yeah. They wanted him to do this deal like American football. And they went out on Memphis TV, and it was terrible. They didn't know how to – it was awful. And I remember the Fabulous ones come out there laughing during this thing. I mean, they couldn't take it serious. And they used the old phrase of which you could never use on TV now, but Stan Lane said, was that a football exhibition or Smear the Queer?
I remember that. Yeah, again, something you cannot say on TV today.
Yeah. So they want the ball to go into the crowd. They want the people to keep the ball away from them, throw it away, throw it around them, you know, all that. Well, it would turn into where the fans would start fighting over the football because they wanted it. They wanted to throw it. Then it would turn into, we don't want to keep it away. We want to throw this ball as hard as we possibly can and hit Jimmy Golden or Robert Fuller right in the nuts with it.
Well, Robert Fuller's a lot there.
It just, but it just, it never worked as people booking it thought it should, including me, because I remember seeing this train wreck. And I booked it in Saltville, Virginia, on a football field.
Well, that makes sense, at least.
Yeah. Well, the problem was, when we would get the ball, me and KC, kids started throwing rocks at us to knock the ball out of us or just hit us with it. We tried it in Kingsport twice. I did it with the same guys I did in Saltville. Flex Tolley, Ron Ray, he was a big 7-foot guy, and Aaron Cross. We're fighting at ringside, and they get the key. We hit one of them something, I don't remember. The key bent in the handcuffs. We can't get the handcuffs off. I need to put that on YouTube because it's. I just remember going, I quit. Forget it. Just pin me. Let's get out of this.
Oh, my goodness.
We then did it in with the Batten Twins and one other guy I can't remember, me and KC and Steve. Same kind of deal. The ball got out in the crowd. This is at the Civic Auditorium. Some goof in the crowd grabs the ball instead of throwing it to the baby faces or chucking it at the heels. He drops back 10 and punts this thing as hard as he can into the ceiling of the Civic Auditorium in Kingsport. Thank God he didn't break a light out. And then I had to tell him, don't throw the ball in the crowd anymore. We got to get out of this thing. You know, it never worked. But not knowing that, just hearing about this football match, you would go see it to see what it was. You wouldn't go a second time. There was a reason they only did it once a year.
Oh, my God. All right, we have a match here between The Beast and Todd Morton. This is Mark Gulin. Beast attacks Morton at the bell, beats him from pillar to post, inside, outside the ring. Morton comes firing back. Beast brings a chair into the ring, gets DQ'd. And of course, Beast nails the referee, Larry Brock, for doing that. Street runs out.
There's another guy. We've not mentioned Larry Brock, I don't think, in any of these.
About him a second. Street ran out, used a chair, sent Beast running. And then we get promos for Street and Garvin afterwards talking about their Loose Leaf Town match. All right, talk about Larry Brock.
Larry Brock is he's a Dothan guy, referee for many years. He all the way back to Gulf Coast. I think I only met Larry maybe once. I might not have met him, but I'm thinking I met him one time years ago. But I've got to know him through Facebook, talking to him some. I've sent some stuff to his wife, some DVDs and stuff from there. But he is a guy that all the boys, that, you know, because they've all talked about Larry Brock in high regard. And all the heels that work Continental said when Larry Brock was the referee, he had your back going to and from the ring. Tracy Smothers once told me Larry Brock would rather fight a man than make love to a woman. The horny lad thing. He said he would rather fight, you know, but, you know, all the boys always talk highly of Larry. And I think his son's now a ref in Alabama on independent shows in Florida and down, you know, the old territory down there. But Larry was just, he was one of those guys. He didn't work the entire territory. He worked the Alabama end. And he was one of those guys. He was good, but, I mean, back then everybody was good. But Larry stood out. He was a guy, he could take great bumps for a referee. That's all. You know, he would go flying. Like, if they do the old deal, like I remember seeing one, I think it was Stubbs. I think it was during this time with Stubbs and Golden where one of them's got the chair and Larry grabs the end of it and they're doing the tug of war. And instead of letting go of it, the heel, like, swings it like an axe. And Larry just goes flying over the top rope and takes a heck of a bump out onto the floor.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, but he was a well-respected guy amongst everybody.
Wow. All right. Johnny Rich. The Riches are back. But Davey is the only one wrestling, as Johnny is now the boss on air of the CWF. What was his title?
He was the event coordinator,
Johnny Rich. And
he was taking Ronnie West's job, as Ronnie has left Continental. I don't know why. I don't think I ever asked Ronnie why he left at this. I would imagine there was no money, you know. Things have really, really dropped off. And except Knoxville. Knoxville's still good. Montgomery is still good. Birmingham, Chattanooga, Johnson City, Dothan has really dropped off. Huntsville, they pretty much don't even go to Huntsville anymore. You know, it's just they don't run Pensacola or Mobile anymore, I don't think, at this point. You know, it's just the territory is – it's on life support.
I always thought Johnny looked weird in this role. I mean, there was his little skinny tie and his white shirt. It just didn't. It didn't fit.
Why? There was no explanation. No,
he just was there. Oh, here's Johnny Rich. He's the new guy.
So, that's exactly what happened. At the end of one of the TVs, Charlie Platt said, "Here's our event coordinator," like he had been all along. Johnny Rich, Johnny, tell him where you're going to be at.
They do that, and then they close the show out with clips of, you know, stuff going on to "Your Mama Don't Dance" by Poison. Okay.
But, you know, Johnny did do a good job doing the interviews for the towns. You know, he did do it because he was a wrestler. His livelihood is how much money he drew. So now you've got to go. And Ronnie West was great at it, too, you know, setting up the matches and being the matchmaker and saying, this, you know, this is what's going to be in the arenas. But there was no explanation of why he doesn't wrestle anymore. And if you go back to WCW TVs at this time, there is a set of interns doing jobs on the Saturday night show and the syndicated show. That's Johnny and Davey Rich.
Interesting. Because they were working as themselves, too, you know.
Yeah, well, not now, not at this point in time. They only had worked as herself, but now they're not full time talent. They're not on the road. They're only going over and doing TVs. So they go over and do TVs as the interns and get paid, and then they come over and work Continental as themselves.
Davis and Wayne went to work as the Galaxians.
Galaxians, right.
All right, October 13th in Knoxville. We got Cactus Jack and Dixie Dynamite going to a draw. Stoves over Robert Fuller by DQ. Morton Street over Beauty and the Beast by DQ. I Quit match for the CW Heavyweight title. Dennis Condrieu over David Rich.
No build up, no explanation. Just here's a gimmick match.
And Southern Boys over Golden and Lee by DQ for CW tag titles. So.
And if you notice, there's six matches and three DQs. Yeah. And one draw.
Now, October 21st in Dothan, we have Dixie Dynamite over Downtown Bruno, Todd Morton over The Beast, Jerry Stubbs over Cactus Jack by DQ. The first of the Lose Leave Town matches, because, of course, they had to do it around the horn. Adrian Street over James Garvin. CW Heavyweight title, Brad Armstrong, who was working with the NWA, over Dennis Condrieu by DQ.
And, Chris, I don't know if you've seen any of their matches live. They were great.
I've heard of it.
I used to tell Brad, I said, you kept Continental open 3 weeks longer just because you and Dennis wrestled each other on that one TV.
I think that was the match. Yeah, that's the match I saw was the TV. Yeah.
I saw them in Morristown and Johnson City. Man, they had great. I mean, it was great chemistry. But you had two greats in there. That Dennis Condrieu is one of the best heels ever. Brad is one of the best wrestlers, period, ever.
And then we have the football match, Golden and Lee over to Southern Boys, because, of course, it's that week of the month to do that match.
Yeah.
All right, Montgomery, October 22nd, television. We have The Beast over Chief Little Lynn. And, Little Lynn won because Beast got DQ, throwing him over the top rope to the floor. But what the main story of this match is Robert Fuller comes out in his Tennessee Stud Colonel Parker type suit and gives Guleen a new beauty to team with. And it's Miss Sylvia in her lingerie and, you know, riding cross or whatever she was using. And this was interesting because the Mark Guleen's whole expressions and all this was great. I mean, he was excited wasn't the word for him.
That is the cue for Bix and Brian at the 605. That is another sound bite of Guleen that you need.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they definitely use that one. I'm sure treatment by Robert Fuller by now, wasn't she? Read between the lines there, folks. All right, Dennis Condrieu has got a DDT challenge for $1,000. Yes, in 1989, we're still doing stuff for $1,000. But, hey, that's kind of a realistic number.
And that's one thing about Southeastern and Continental. They did make it realistic. They made it to where it's believable. If you would have went out there, okay, there's 500 people in the building. And if you were to go out and say, this is a DDT challenge for $25,000, they'd have laughed you out of the building. Yeah. But you go out there and say, hey, this is, you know, for a grand, and it's believable.
So, yeah, Robert comes out, and he says, I'm going to put $2,000 of my own money. If Jerry Stubbs will come back, take the challenge, Stubbs comes out, and he puts $1,000 of his money up. But he wants to do his figure four challenge. So this ends up with Fuller accidentally hitting Condrieu. Stubbs puts the figure four on Fuller. Condrieu DDT Stubbs. Faces runs out. You know, it ends up being a big brawl. And this is all setting up the upcoming Thunderdome matches. Which,
And the inflation calculator, 1989, $1,000, is $1,937.39 in today's money. So almost $2,000. It's almost doubled. So, and minimum wage at that point in time was like $4.50 or something.
Now, the reason why Terry Garvin's gone is because he's gone back to Texas. He's gone back to work with Jarrett. So Beast is here by himself, and now he's working Agent Street. Sylvia's out there in all her get up. Beast's not very good as a worker by himself. Street pins him, and this feud's going on, but yeah. And on this taping, let's go over some of the jobber names. The Intruders.
The Intruders were Jack Lord and Lee Peek.
Panther.
Chief Little Lynn. No, that Little Lynn went back to back right there.
Yeah, back to back.
African Assassin is okay. Bill Taff. Yeah.
All right, we got Daryl Hall, not from Daryl Hall and Oates, but another Daryl Hall. Keith Middleman.
Yeah. Those guys were guys from North Georgia and Chattanooga that Chief Little Lynn brought down. Johnny Gilbert was part of their clique.
The Eliminators?
Eliminators and Mercenary probably were Lee Peek, Jack Lord, and Bill Taft.
Of course, not Jack Lord from Hawaii Five-0. So, there you go there. Let's see. A lot of the same matches around the horn. We got Street and Garvin in Birmingham on October 30th. Football match on October 30th. We have, let's see here. November the 5th, Montgomery, back to TV again.
There's October 30th, Scott Armstrong against Bruno.
Yes, DC Diamond against Downtown Bruno.
In the opening match.
Yep, DC Diamond and Bruno worked a few matches.
And Bruno is managing in the main event and Fuller. So Bruno was in three of the six matches.
Yeah. Now, who was the Dreamweaver that I see here working that Lucille Mississippi show? Must have been probably a local guy, right?
Yeah, I would imagine.
All right, Montgomery on November the 5th. Brickhouse Brown is back after a four-year absence in the territory. Coming out to Funky Cold Medina by Tone Loke. And this is the full recreation of what they did in Memphis a year earlier. Robert Fuller comes out. They recruit Brick to join the Stub stable. Robert gives him his wallet. And Brick walks off, holding Robert Fuller's wallet in his hand. So, Brickhouse Brown, this is fresh off the Blackbirds run with Iceman and Harold Harris. I love Brick in this era. I thought he was awesome right here.
Yeah, and here's the thing, too, though. There's so much lap over of TV now, especially Continental in Memphis, which we've had it before, but it's really lapped over now. And they're doing a complete retake of something they did a year earlier that we all saw.
Well, Robert Fuller's whole deal was a retake of that whole Memphis run. It's about.
Yeah.
So, yep. But more on Brick later. Next, we get a promo, and this is one of the favorite stories from the previous episodes of this show. As Dixie Dynamite and the Southern Boys are talking about the upcoming Meat Coat Tournament. And this is where they describe what's going on here. And they have female fans with them. Of course, Tracy Smothers is hitting on a female fan who actually wrote Steve Armstrong's name down on her ticket. She wanted to win. And then Dixie Dynamite, Steve Armstrong demonstrate the other facets of the tournament. I love this video. And of course, the story we told in the previous show, you got to tell it again. What happened to me?
They go. This is 89. They owned one mink coat, and they have now gotten 4 years out of one coat. And during these TVs leading to these mink coat tournaments, going to bumper, you either had Sylvia or Laura wearing the mink coat on TV, you know, going to the bumpers, a little video of them showing it off. This coat now is 4 years old, and the hair is coming off of it. It's looking, it's like, what was the Seinfeld? Where was it? The one of them had the coat and it went into the chicken, or it went into, you know, it came apart, it shedded.
Yeah.
That's what it's looking like. But what they did was, when you came into the, bought your ticket and you came in, they had shoe boxes lined out with every wrestler's name on them. And then they had paper and pen and pencil there. You wrote on there your name. Then you dropped it in the wrestlers that you thought was going to win the tournament. Then they would take them to ringside and sit them on the table. And as the guy lost, Laura would come out and take their box away. So we went down to the last box. They would then open the box, reach in the box, pull out a lucky name, because that's who you thought was going to win, and you got into the box that got the drawing, and they would call out a name. It was the only time of the year that they were allowed to bring their wives or girlfriends to the matches, because one of them was going to win that coat in one of the towns. The first year, they had Welch and Golden cousins win them in all the towns, you know, and they got a 4-year run out of this coat. Girls went, guys took their baby. We're gonna go down there. I know Jerry Stubbs gonna win. You just put your name Jerry Stubbs his box, and you're going to get a chance to win that, or Steve or Scott or you know whoever. It was a date night on a chance. That's how they got their girlfriends or wives to go. You got a chance to win a mink coat. All you got to do is go to wrestling.
Smart move.
Yeah.
You ain't going to win.
And nobody ever caught on.
You ain't going to win, but it's a smart move. Oh, man, I love it. That's just a great pro wrestling. All right, Charlie Platt sends a camera to the back where the Stud Stable is celebrating downtown Bruno's birthday. And his present from the Stud Stable is Brickhouse Brown's contract. Brickhouse is upset with this because he made a deal with Robert Fuller and doesn't want to go with Downtown Bruno. Again, the same thing from Memphis.
Same thing. And notice they did not do this in front of the live audience. They would have been killed.
Why would they have been killed? Tell us what.
Because it's his signing bonus. They gave him a watermelon.
Which they did in Memphis. On live television.
Yeah. But here is the thing. Yes, that times have changed, and you know, we talk about all this stuff you can't do now, and you can't. This was too much.
Oh, yeah. It,
this is too much.
They're still doing that, you know.
Yeah. It's too much. It's not. I said earlier, you know, I don't believe in cheap heat. This wasn't heat. This wasn't. I'm going to the matches to see him get even. This was. Why are we watching this?
The thing is, you know, the next year in NWA, it gets completely worse when Ole Anderson and that whole deal with Rocky King, and I mean,
yeah,
it's wrestling. I mean, it's a sad statement, but that was the wrestling of that era was about playing those racial stereotypes and those angles like that. And, it's odd to look at the day compared to what, you know, what's going on today and just see how different it was, you know, calling the black wrestler was always called boy, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's not sensitive. Let's put it that way. All right. Brad Armstrong and the Lethal Weapon, Dennis Carnegie. And this was a hell of a damn match.
Yeah.
Hey, Brock got popped in this match. Brad DDT Carnegie on the chair. Fans went crazy on that one. And then he just started throwing punch at the punch. Carnegie comes back. He DDTs Brad on the chair. Brad's juicing like crazy. Dixie Dynamite and Jerry Stubbs run out and make the save. Carnegie comes out afterwards with a cut on his head, gloating over what just happened. A bloody Brad Armstrong comes out, vowing revenge on Condry. This was great television.
Yeah, but it was too little too late. You know, it just really at this point in time, that is the only thing that they had that would grab your interest. And that's not a knock on anybody. It just was, this was something new and fresh, everything else they'd seen. You know, great talent. With Fuller, Golden, Stubbs, Adrian, Cactus, you know,
Brickhouse,
yeah, great. You're right. All great guys, all great wrestlers. It just, the territories had started running their course.
Do you think the mistake was still trying to hold on to Alabama? You think if they would have just decided to move everything to Tennessee and...
Yeah, because I'll tell you why. They could have moved back to Knoxville. But, well, they could... Okay. They could not have because they were now tied into Montgomery and David Woods. If Ron Fuller would have had USA and it would have kept going, if the hockey thing would have not went and he kept USA, he had East Kentucky, he had East Tennessee, he had Southwest Virginia, he could have expanded into Ohio, he could have expanded into West Virginia and parts of North Carolina. All a 4-hour or 5-hour trip from Knoxville, you could have been home every night. And they could have kept, and those areas were not being ran. West Virginia didn't have, I mean, Crockett would hit Beckley and Huntington and Charleston, but there was other towns. There was other places. Southern Ohio, all kinds of little towns. If they could have got the TV on, they're out of I'm trying to think of the, Portsmouth, Ohio, right there outside of Ashland, Channel 30. If they could have reached so much more. They could have went to Lexington because Fuller was not far from there and Jarrett had been far removed from Lexington. But once Woods took over, there's no hope of leaving Alabama. And Alabama's dead. You look here, Foley, Alabama, National Guard Armory. Continental in Pensacola was always, you know, at the Civic Center, I think it was. Now they're at the National Guard Armory. They're at Fort Whiting Armory in Mobile. They're back to the Armory instead of Expo Hall. You know, they've now went to small 200- and 300-seat buildings to where 3 years earlier they were selling out the bigger major arenas in the towns. And it just – Alabama was dead. It was done. I mean, that's why they sold it. It was done. And there was nothing you could do to bring it back.
Nope. Now, interesting match on this taping. We have Cactus Jack, Robert Fuller, and Brian Lee over Chief Little Lynn, Dean Ho, and Jerry Stubbs.
And where in the world did they find Dean Ho in 1989?
I don't think that was the original. If I remember right, that was not the same Dean Ho. Because Dean Ho would have been... Let's see, how old would Dean Ho have been? Dean Ho would have been even 51... He retired in 1983.
Okay, yeah, I saw him here in 80, in 81, and he was an older guy then.
It wouldn't have been him. But, yeah, the reason why Stubbs was involved there is he took the place of one of the other job guys, and they did that whole angle there. So, there you go. All right, yeah, Pensacola, November 19th. You know, Fuller against Stubbs, Conjure against Armstrong, Golden and Leo against Southern Boys, and then your last TV taping ever in Continental is on the 20th of November in Montgomery. Johnny Rich does this sit-down interview with Ron Starr, who's coming to the area. First time he's been back in 5 years. And he says, coming for Cactus Jack. Now, Ron Starr said that the WF contacted him to come in, but he refused because he wanted to be in Continental. Come out to Cactus Jack.
Yeah.
And then the Studs cut a promo afterwards talking about how Cactus Jack ended Ron Starr's son's career in Texas, which was a total BS. But
and the people knew that.
But Ron Starr, who had been, you know, everywhere, another guy who been in Puerto Rico, Canada, been, you know, working different places. And here he is on the last TV taping in Continental and the last match of Continental, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, but interesting. Ron Starr's a guy who I love. Ron Starr, I've watched so much of him in Puerto Rico lately and seen other work of his.
Stuff in Portland was great when he was a young baby face out there. It was great.
What a great hand he was. He was a guy that he would work these lower profile territories, and that's what he liked to do. He worked the Maritimes or work Calgary, Puerto Rico, you know, some in and out of Portland, in and out of Southeastern. I mean, that was Ron Starr. I mean, the highest profile he ever did was he had that short run with Ole in 84, 85, with Ronnie Garvin.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what were your thoughts on Ron Starr? I thought he was awesome.
Just what you said, you liked it. The match he had with Mick on this TV, they beat each other to death. I mean, just hard way, just, you know, it was the stuff that you would see years later with Mick and Terry Funk, you know, where they just beat each other bloody pulps.
Starr comes out to Eye of the Tiger, which I thought was hilarious, and that's 1989. And he runs to the ring, beats on Cactus. Cactus just bumps like crazy on the concrete. Cactus juices early. Starr's just working over that cut. Backdrops him as he's running over the railing. Goes into the bleachers, which you never saw. And the crowd's going crazy as Starr's just punching the hell out of him. I mean, the crowd starts running. This is like Bruiser Brody in All Japan. It's just a spectacle. Finally go back to the ringside area. Starr uses the steel chairs to the back. Cactus just completely bleeding. They go to the dressing room. Starr cuts back out. The crowd's going mad for this guy. Cuts a great promo afterwards. And that was the last match in the history of continental wrestling television. Starr, Cactus Jack.
And the thing about it was... I believe Ron had been there a couple weeks before he ever got on TV. So, and then he worked out till Thanksgiving when they shut down. I don't know what would have became of the two of them if it would have kept going. They had the TV because, I mean, my God, they hadn't even put any fuel on the fire yet. This was the first meeting, you know. It's just... two tough guys out there just beating each other up.
Exactly. And before that, Dennis Condrey came out for his $1,000 DDT challenge, and a fan took a challenge, which probably was a work fan, wouldn't you think? Dropped him, and he had a minute. So the deal was, you hit him with a DDT, and then the guy has a minute to get up and touch all four corners. If he did that, he won the $1,000. So, of course, the guy doesn't get up at all. Burrhead Jones runs out, playing off to what happened, you know, a while back. Condrey says, "I'm not DDTing you. Your head's like a foreign object." Again, racial stereotype. But he DDTs him anyway. Burrhead, though, tries to get up, and then Condrey just destroys him. So,
Burrhead was over.
In Alabama, in that area, he was over.
People remembered him, and, you know, and he could come in, and that he kind of became the Roughhouse Fargo, to where, you know, just once a year, I'm going to put him back on, and I'm going to get in there, you know, we're going to settle the score, and I got Burrhead as my partner, and it would pop a house some.
Yeah. Now, what was the last Knoxville show?
Thanksgiving night.
Thing I have is Pensacola on the 26th.
Hold on, and I will tell you. Let me look that up. And I'll tell you the story about...
Let me check and see.
That's what I'm looking
at. Yeah, the last date I have is November 26th, 1989, in Pensacola.
I was sitting at the merchandise table waiting, like I did, for them to bring me the programs to sell. And I heard Johnny Rich tell somebody, and I'm trying to think who it was.
Okay. You said Thanksgiving, right? So that would have been on the 23rd. So Pensacola's after. All right, but go ahead and tell your story.
So, but I heard Johnny Rich tell some, and I don't remember who it was. Might have been one of the Southern Boys. Birmingham's canceled Monday. Matter of fact, no towns next week.
So they probably didn't make that show, period, at Pensacola show.
Yeah. He said, I think tonight is it. And I was sitting there, you know, and I'm thinking, what's he talking about? Because Knoxville was still drawing a couple thousand people. I mean, it wasn't doing the 4,000 it was doing a year or so earlier, but it was still paying the bills. But the problem was, it probably was paying the bills, period, for the territory at the time. And Knoxville, Thanksgiving night, was always the big card. It was always, you know, close to full, if not sold out, and it wasn't. And they just like Cornette with Smoky Mountain, just like Blackjack Mulligan with the last run of the original Southeastern, even though it had become Southern Championship Wrestling Incorporated. When Thanksgiving didn't draw, it's time to close the doors. And that's what happened. And, you know, that was by 89, the only places left were Portland, Continental,
Memphis,
Dallas. I think
Continental America, yes.
Yeah. Nelson Royal had tried. Atlantic Coast will come right after this and try. But the territory system was no more. I mean, it ran its course other than Jerry Jarrett and Don Owens, who were the last two. And the reason why, they knew their limitations. They never tried to grow too big for the britches, as the old saying goes. They never tried to take on the world. They didn't want the world. They wanted to go to their own beds at night. They wanted their little piece of the country. That's it. You know, that's what we do. Jerry got involved in Dallas, but he wasn't down there every day. You know, he had someone down there running stuff for him that he could trust. But, you know, it was sad because look at all these guys, that, you know, Smothers, Armstrong, which it would work out for them. They go to WCW.
It took a while.
Not immediately. It'll take, you know, it'll take a few months. But, you know.
Cactus went in January. Robert went back to Memphis. Street, that's it for Street. Condry went to work with Savoldi. Him and Doug teamed up as Lethal Weapons.
Right.
Brian Lee went with Fuller, of course. Brick, I think Brick may have went back to Memphis for a while or was working around there. Ron Starr went back to doing what Ron Starr did, went back to Puerto Rico. Goulin, that was it for him.
That was his career. Yeah, that was his career.
Jimmy Golden didn't go back with none of them. I mean, he didn't go back with the...
No, but here's what happened. Here's what happened in my part of the world. You had the independent... Well, you already had, you know, the outlaw wrestling here, which is called independent now. So now you have no territory, and other people start to run towns. Well, Archie Goldie's available. Jimmy Golden's available. The Riches are available. Fuller, Ron Wright, if you can get him to agree to do something with wrestling at the time, the Armstrongs. So now these guys who could not afford this talent before, they can bring a couple of them in instead of bringing the whole crew. They can bring a couple of guys in, run a town, do well, make money. And you got experienced names that people know to advertise. You don't have Joe Blow against, you know, the fake whoever in your main event. You got Jimmy Golden against the Mongolian Stomper.
Yeah, and that's what would happen for the next couple of years until Smokey started up.
Yeah.
And, of course, you got to tell the story of Ron West and the TV deal here.
Okay, which I think you covered on the Between the Sheets about what all of these TVs now – They replayed for 3 weeks the last taping. It ran 3 weeks in a row while they're trying to figure out what to do.
All right, one of these shows from 89 that we talked about, I can't remember which one, it may have been that July 3rd stuff, aired on a TV station in Alabama in 1994.
Wow.
Because, what I have it off of, the commercials are from 1994. So it was still airing somewhere.
Probably Channel 13, or was it 13 WCOW?
I don't remember which town it was in.
Probably on Woods station.
Who knows how long they're airing the old Continental stuff on those stations.
Yeah, that's true.
Go ahead and talk about Ron West.
But you have Knoxville, you got Kingsport TV, you got Chattanooga TV, you got Dothan, Huntsville, Pensacola, Mobile, Columbus, Birmingham, and a few other smaller stations that all got weekly TVs from Continental. You then had Jackson, Mississippi, Lake Charles, Louisiana, New Orleans, that Eddie Gilbert had picked up when he came in there and got the Continental TV on the old Bill Watts network. So now you have Gilbert and Paulie working, trying to get all the TV slots. You also have Robert Fuller trying to get a backer to keep this thing going, because he had this idea and called Tom Pritchard and told Tom that he wanted to go with Kerry Von Erich against Tom as the top program. And they were going to tape in January, and they were going to just put a little crew together, keep the tapes going, going to show reruns until then, and then we'll come back and start running with that program. And then you had other people that came in and tried to get the TV times. And Ron West walks in, and he opens up North American Championship Wrestling, because Birmingham, Huntsville, Chattanooga, Knoxville, Kingsport, TV, all are in his name. The contract is in Ron West's name. Have been since 1985. He starts taping in Birmingham. It lasts about 3 months. And that's it. I mean, just couldn't get the funding to get it going. But if you've ever seen the programs that Ron was doing, he had some pretty good programs. Because Ron did what Dundee did for the tapings. He brought Chick Donovan over, who hadn't, people knew who he was. He hadn't been there. Ivan Koloff, Manny Fernandez, new to the area. Junkyard Dog. Brought Wrestling 2 back. Brought the Armstrongs back. Peggy and Bambi.
Gordy
came in. He had some great talent, but the problem was the talents had just, they've been killed. I mean, it was a hard sale, and it just didn't last. But I thought Ron West put, Brent West was the commentator. Rodney was the ring announcer, Ronnie's sons. They did great jobs. Rodney did the voiceovers or the local promos for the towns. Ron was the promoter and would come out and make the decisions on the calls and make the matches. And it was a family business. And maybe if that would have came along a year earlier, it would have lasted longer. Not in Alabama, but maybe, you know, East Tennessee. But it was too little, too late.
There was like you go into 1990, and you see where people are trying to run some of the old towns. You got Mississippi. Ken Massey's running shows there.
I've not heard of
JYD and Buddy Landell on top. Fantastics against Johnny Mantell and Ken Massey. That's February 90. You're looking at Sika was running shows in Pensacola. Here's Iceman, yep. Parsons and Agent Street to double count out. Paul Orndorff over Kamala by DQ.
Bill Needham was running Knoxville area, the greater metro Knoxville area, Crossville, Morristown, Newport, Lake City. And Bill did real well for about 3 years.
Southeastern Championship Wrestling in Mississippi and Alabama. Running Greenwood, Mississippi, Louisville, Mississippi, Florence, Alabama. We have Cooley and Dr. Tom on top. Hurricane Bronson and Lou Fabiano against Don Harris and Frankie the Top of Lancaster. Florence, Alabama. They got Pritchard and Cooley on top there. So, I mean, you're seeing people trying to run these places, but there's nothing that's, you know, sticking. And nothing really stuck until Cornette. You know, it's a full time deal until Cornette came came in 1992. So,
Here's a great what if. What if Cornette comes in May, and they stay? He doesn't go back to the NWA, and he becomes the booker after Dundee.
Oh yeah, that's a great question. It is a great question, a great what if, definitely. But it's a sad end to the era, because I love Continental Television all the way to the end. It was always entertaining, always fun, and it's just sad to see it go. All right, now, of the years we've covered here, Continental, 85 to 89, I'm going to see what you think here. All right, what's the best match that you saw of that run?
Ooh.
Live television. Whatever.
Man, I saw so much. That's a good question. Cooley and Landell was always great. Always great. I would put that, you know, up towards the top. I'm trying to think. Gosh, I saw so much. Fuller and Golden with the Nightmares was great. You know, that was there. There was just so much that goes on. I don't know. But, when you think Continental, you automatically think Fuller, Golden, Armstrong. You know, then Pritchard. Pritchard and Brad. I would say, you know, looking at the overall picture, the best matches consistently. Cooley, Landell, when Buddy was motivated. Tom Pritchard and Brad Armstrong. And we didn't get enough of Tom Pritchard and Brad Armstrong.
Yeah. All right. Worst match.
Oh, the woman beast and Miss Linda. Miss Linda, if you was here, I would hug you right now. I felt so... 27 years later, and I still have tears in my eyes for you, Miss Linda, having to work with that woman.
All right. Best angle.
Oh, the turn in the cage, the creation of the bullet when Robert Fuller took it, no doubt.
They popped the territory.
When the whole setup, and for him to do that turn, and people thought we'll never see Bob Armstrong again.
Worst angle.
The Russian team against the Nightmares.
Yeah,
that's pretty. And the watermelon thing with Brickhouse.
Pretty bad. Most overrated. Worker. Guy that got pushed too much, shouldn't have got pushed as high as he did.
I really don't know if there was one there.
All right. Interesting.
I mean, because everybody fit their role, and they knew their role. And it wasn't for me, it wasn't to go out there and outshine that guy. It was to go out there and do my job that I'm booked in today. Because tomorrow I may be booked in his job, and I don't want him to be below me and outdo me when I'm in that position and he's in this position. They knew that. They knew the business.
Yeah. And the most underrated.
Ooh. Probably Scott Armstrong.
That's a good answer.
Because, I mean, Scotty was great, but he just, you know, his brothers and dad got the spotlight.
Yeah.
I mean, he had part of it, but, you know, and I think his size hurt him a little bit because he wasn't as thick as the other ones, you know. But, I mean, hey, he went out there and had just as good as match as Stevie. You know, he went out there and had just as good as match as a lot of other people. Let's go back to that most overrated because I just thought of one. Larry Hamilton. Not Jody Hamilton's brother, but yeah. And that guy, Man, they would bring him back, and he would double-cross him and do something else again and leave, and they would bring him back again.
He could work, but he didn't have the charisma. He could work. He was a good technical guy, but he just he didn't have the charisma needed in that territory. With all those great promos and personalities, he just he didn't fit that way.
And the whole thing with Tom Pritchard in the watch, if that would have been done with one of the Armstrongs, they could have got some mileage out of that. But with Hamilton, it just.
All right, this is going to be an interesting one. I'm curious to hear your reaction on this one. All right, if you have one announcer to pick to denounce the television, Gordon Solie or Charlie Platt?
Solie. And Platt was great, but Solie had that national, he had that aura to him, that he had that awe factor of, man, that's Gordon Solie standing right there.
All right. Booker, who was the best Booker?
Ron Fuller.
Who was the worst Booker?
Robert Fuller at the end. No, and that's, here's the thing. Don't anybody start sending me hate mail because I'm talking bad about Rob. I love Robert Fuller. But here's the deal. Robert had just booked Continental for the better part of a year. In 87. He then booked Memphis for over a year, 88 into 89. He needed a break. That's hard. 52 TVs a week, a year, six nights a week, live events, sometimes more if you got double shots on Saturday and Sunday. That's too much mentally to take in, plus having to wrestle every night. He needed a break, but he also needed a job, so he took the job.
And that's also why, you know, everybody complains about WWE these days. They don't change bookers, really. The Vince McMahon is still the be-all, end-all of everything. So that's
right.
Why you get a lot of staleness.
And I think maybe if somebody would have had 6 months and let Robert just work there, just bring Robert in as talent, let him be on TV, let him, you know, go out there and talk and have his matches and just, you know, just go do that, then take over the book after 6 months. I think it would have been so much better. It would have been great. But here's the problem. Who was available to trust to book it those last 4 months?
Oh, I mean, they're guys, but it's like who would have took the job?
Right. But not only, well, there would have been guys taking the job if it was offered.
Well, right. What about Dutch?
Dutch is in Memphis. And he is helping book in Memphis at the time in 89.
All right. Let me see here. Try to think of some reasonable examples off the top of my head. The guys you think about are in working for play either NWA or WWF pretty much, either as talent or working as bookers.
Randy Hales, if Randy Hales would have got the booking job in 89, it would have been a different story.
Yeah, we didn't talk about his exit. We talked about him being there, but.
Yeah. There really was no exit. He was brought in to be Dundee's replacement. And he was dealing with David Woods. He was dealing with Dundee. He was getting set up to take over. And David Woods said, I'm just going to go with Robert. And Randy went home. And I think the reason was Randy didn't. I don't know. I don't think David Woods understood who Randy was and what he did for the Jarrett Corporation. And he was a young guy, and I think he was probably afraid to let a guy that young that was not a wrestler be the booker. But we know what he did in the 90s in Memphis with young talent, and there was young talent in Continental. And Randy will not fail. He will give it 100%. He would have made it work somehow. Then when his run is up, then bring Robert Fuller back as the booker, because they're completely opposite in booking philosophies, and it won't be a continuation of what you just saw for the last year.
And, well, I just thought of one name, a guy who was trying to get out of where he was at and who tried to get to the territory back the next year, Eddie Gilbert.
They would have never give Eddie and Paul another shot after the way they left.
They were negotiating with David Woods.
Yeah, but they were negotiating about buying the company.
I'm saying. Yeah, they would if they would have bought it,
but not booking. But if they would have had control, here's the thing: if Eddie gets mad, he's gone. If Eddie, you know, and I don't blame Eddie too, because I've been the same way. You know, if I'm somewhere I don't like it, hey, I'm not going back. I don't need this. I can go somewhere else, make the same money or more. You know, if he's the owner, is he going to treat it the same way and just say, the heck with it, I'm going to go work somewhere else? I don't need the headaches. I can go work somewhere else.
Yeah. Makes sense. And, all right, who do you wish would have worked Continental? As a regular.
Bigelow was there, you know, like we talked about on the last time, for that 1 week. I would have liked to seen him there is a heel. And I would like to see him, you know, if he just think of this, he's there and he gets smashed over people. He's just smashed over every week on TV. Who can beat me? I'm the beast from the east. I'm the monster. You cannot beat me. They keep smashing him over. And then here comes Terry Gordy. I'm the original Bam Bam. This is my hometown. You're standing right here in my what I grew up watching, what made me fall in love with wrestling, and you're talking about all that stuff from New Jersey, and I'm a Southern boy. Off to the races you go.
Yeah, I was thinking, I mean, that, in a scenario like that, either him or Furnace.
Yeah,
that would have been good stuff, and that's an interesting name. Somebody you wish never would have worked Continental.
The Russians and the Lady Beast.
All right, and the last question: when you think of Continental Championship Wrestling, who comes to mind first?
Ron Fuller, because it was his mind, it was his drive, it was his passion, it was his goal, it was his money, his body, his blood, that made it work.
There you go.
And once Ron Fuller was out of the picture, it was just endless disappointments. Phantom title changes. Guys promised to come in that don't show up. You know, just, it was a mess.
Yeah. Oh, I got another question. I mean, this is interesting because you look at the timelines, they both ran for about the same amount of time. Which do you prefer, Continental or Smoky Mountain?
Continental. And here's the thing. This will surprise a lot of people. I live right in the heart of that territory. I saw very little of it because I was already in the business. You know, I was booked places. You know, I was out wrestling and I was running towns. I had my own stuff to worry about. And, you know, it wasn't magical to me. It was people... the next generation, they would tell you, I'd much rather have Smoky Mountain. Continental, and here's the deal too. I take Continental Championship Wrestling over Continental Wrestling Federation any day of the week.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because that CCW, brother, when that party all the time came on and you heard welcome to Continental Championship Wrestling featuring stars from out throughout the continental United States and around the world, hosted by your... announcer of the year, Gordon Solie. Brother, I waited all week to hear that.
Well, first off, it was a situation by Yaz, the original
Yeah, but that only lasted for 2 weeks.
The original theme, and then Party Auditorium yeah. came.
Actually, the original theme, the very first Continental TV show where they're getting out of the limos was the from that Beverly Hills Cop
That's
theme.
That's right, yeah.
Then Situation lasted for 2 weeks, and somebody settled on Party All the Time.
Yep.
And then they did away with that, and it just came up a CCW and went away. White and Wedding. then it went to White Wedding.
Which was played out a lot. I mean, I got tired of hearing that song for a while. But, yeah, interesting stuff, interesting answers. All right, plug time. Talk about the West Virginia stuff, and what else you got going on?
Okay, I have been up, as I said at the beginning of this, for days. I don't know who listens to this from where I get. Me and Chris get all kinds of compliments about this program. Thank you, because this is something you can tell that I'm passionate about. This is my childhood. This helped with this and Mid-Atlantic Wrestling and Memphis Wrestling, why that I've made my life choices to be in this business. But, you know, I'm a Tennessee boy. I'm an Appalachian boy. And West Virginia is not far from here. And other than Tennessee, I have spent most of my career between Chattanooga and Pittsburgh, up down the Appalachians. West Virginia is my second home. And, folks, they're hurting. You can see it on the news. You can hear about it. I stood there today and watched it. I saw it. Elk View, West Virginia, they let us take supplies. We took two trailer loads and the van of us up there to help unload and settle out. When we pulled in, it was overwhelming, the amount of homeless people standing in line in this parking lot to get a hot dog. Heartbreaking to see children that have been in the same clothes for a week and are covered in mud. And they had to walk with their parents for miles to get to relief because there's still floodwaters and it rained yesterday up there and they had all kinds of trouble. We took today 200 cases of water because it will be months before they can drink tap water, cook with it, brush their teeth with it, anything else. They said at a bare minimum, half a gallon of water a day per person to stay hydrated. That's under regular normal conditions, and they're not out running or working and cleaning and doing all that and sweating. They needed to brush their teeth. They need everything. They need new underwear. They need new socks, T-shirts, clothes, shoes. Most of them got out with what's on their back from this 1,000-year flood. I'm going back Friday to I'm going to Charleston to the Red Cross. I have a truckload of clothes that we're taking to Charleston. Then I have another truckload of stuff that is going back to Elk View. I'm going to spend my 4th of July up there taking supplies and helping feed people because they need it. If there's anybody out there that lives in my part of the world, if you have any kind of donations or anything, you can take them to Calvary Baptist Church, 1238 Pine Street, Kingsport, Tennessee. Just go over there Monday through Friday, regular business hours. Tell them you'd like to help, whether it's a dollar, whether it's a bottle, case of water, whether it's some new underwear or socks, whether it's some canned food. If you live anywhere up that way, you can go to Elk View, West Virginia. Get off of the exit, hang a right, go down to Main Street, hang a right. Right there is Elk View Baptist Church Association. They're taking donations. That is a homeless shelter now. This flood, when Katrina came, you know, it hit a major city, and the world was on top of it. This flood lasted for 200 miles from the Ohio border to the Virginia border. Towns like White, Sulphur Springs will have to be rebuilt. Towns like Clay, West Virginia, are probably never going to be seen again. As we left Elk View, West Virginia today, we saw bulldozers just pushing the buildings over, scooping them up, putting them in trucks, and driving away with them. I have a friend and his family in Clendenin, which is the next town up from Elk View. three generations of their family lost everything that they've ever worked their life for. Their homes, their cars, their pictures, their childhood trophies, their children's toys, their grandmother's family Bible, everything is gone. And there's dozens and dozens of communities up there like that. I'm going to be putting up some videos. They allowed us to shoot some videos and take some pictures today to show the world what's happening up there right now. And I'm going to work on that when I finish doing this. And then I'm going to go to bed for several hours because I'm beat, brother. But if you can help, if you're up that way, if you're in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, Virginia, you know, if you're in a few-hour drive, just take a few hours and go up there and help somebody. You know, this story that I was heard today, and I read last night, there was a group of people that got out of the flood above up on Route 4. They made it to the homeless shelter, and they cried. This is grown people, grown men and women. They cried tears, and they said, if you just give us a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, we'll leave. Think about that. You know, I saw children today. They don't understand what's going on. You know, a lady gave us a tour just around where we were allowed to go because, you know, you're not allowed to go into the disaster area, only to the relief. And she took us out back behind behind the church where there was a football and baseball field. The home run fence and the foul poles are 5 foot high. There was about 6 inches sticking out of the mud. The mud is diseased because the sewer has ran into it. The smell is so bad that you have to pull your shirt up over your face to keep from throwing up. People are living 200 feet away from that because they got nowhere else to go. You know, they didn't do anything to bring this on. You know, this is a disaster. And it's going to take a miracle to rebuild it. And we just got to help them. They're human beings. They're not dogs. They're not animals. They're human beings. They're people. And we got to remember that and help them all that we can help them. You know, and it's just, you know, I'm going to give up my holiday money to go help somebody because I've seen it. You know, and these people have been good to me. I've made a living going to this state for many years. You know, Chris, the Sunday before the flood, and I think I plugged it on the last podcast, Misty and I wrestled in Chesapeake, West Virginia, which is about 20 miles from where I went today, and it sits on the river. And we dressed behind the building outside there and on the river, and we were out there, and Misty said, boy, I could live right here on this river. Look at this. It's so nice and beautiful, and, you know, and we laughed. And one of the guys that was there with me was Chet Cartwright. And we said, you've never seen this river flooded. 4 days later, Chet and his family, they're the ones that lost everything. You know, that it's just, it's something, you know, that's why I got involved. I've got another friend up there that I have been calling since Friday. We can't get an answer. We don't know where he's at. I have no idea. I have left him message after message since Friday. You know, Facebook me, call me, text me something. Let me know. There's 25 people dead that they know of. They're just now able to get into the homes where they can go to door. It's going to rise. Today, I saw pictures on Facebook and people were talking about it. They rescued an elderly couple that had been floating in a car since Thursday, just bounced around. And a man went out into waist-high water and put them on his back and carried them back to dry land. You know, but once you get them to dry land, once you get them to the disaster areas, they don't have anything. They don't have anywhere to live. Lots of donations came in today. We, like I said, 200 cases of water. It took us about 15 minutes to unload it. And in 10 minutes after we unloaded, it had been distributed. Now, a lot of people is going to go up there and they would see all that stuff laying there and they think, well, this they got enough. We went that one time and they're not going to go back. this will be years before it's ever back to normal, but it's going to be months. Most of the schools are gone. Clendenin, the little town there, the fire department's gone, police department's gone, city hall's gone, public library's gone, churches are gone, high school is gone, middle school is gone. They're hoping to save the elementary school. And if they do, it's going to take months to clean it, and they're going to have to send them, bus them to other areas just to get an education. So, I mean, that's just, you can go go on Facebook. It's called the Elk River Flood Relief Foundation. Every morning they put up a list of what is needed right then, desperately needed right then. If you can get it to them and can help them, please do it. There's phone numbers on there to call. Anything you can do is much appreciated because, I mean, brother, these people, they need it.
Yeah, it's a bad situation. It's not getting talked about nearly enough.
No, here's the other thing, and I don't get into politics because I believe they're as big as work as wrestling is. So I'm not even, they're predetermined, the elections are predetermined, they already know who the president's going to be. Here's the deal, though. There's 44 counties underwater. As we was there today, only 3 of them have been declared emergency disaster areas. So until they are declared that, FEMA cannot come in.
That's insane. And the media is just not, I mean, it's not nearly as covered as it should be. And, you know, it's mainly because of, one of the reasons because it's where it's at and other stuff too.
Yeah. But
it's a bad situation. So yeah, if you want to help out, you know, do what Bo said or try to find other ways, you know, on the internet, you know, to go through. But yeah, it's a bad deal. It's a bad deal for everybody. But other than that, any future bookings you have coming up?
Yeah, we got, trying to think where all I'm at here. 30th of July, we'll be in Dublin, Virginia, New River Valley Fair. The 27th of July, Wednesday night, we do this show every year. It's at a 4-H camp in Princeton, West Virginia, which thank God is not flooded. And what it is a they bring people from a home where they're mentally or physically handicapped. And they take them to 4-H camp once a year, and they get to go to camp. And on Wednesday night, we do an hour and a half program. And then after that, they do a dance. And it's something, brother, to see the joy in these people's face. They're so happy. And it's just something we do. But they let public come in. So if you're around there on the 27th, you can come up to that. I'm trying to think what else I've got. Shoot, I don't have my book. Hold on, I do have my book in front of me. I've been up for many hours, folks. Here's another one. September 17th, I've got the Barbersville, West Virginia. Hopefully that's going to happen in the afternoon. Cornette's going to be there. Still working on that card. That's a big card from Nationwide Wrestling. Scotty Ace there at the Fall Festival. Then that night, we're going to be in Rio Grande, Ohio at college there on the 10th of September. Supposed to be Montgomery at the Fall Festival, Montgomery, West Virginia. No idea if that'll happen. Racine, West Virginia that night. Don't know if that'll happen. A lot of these West Virginia dates are canceled. I mean, that's another thing about this flood. It's affecting us because we can't go there and, you know, do the shows. I'm not worried about that. These people, if they do get back on their feet, they have no job to go to. You know, they don't have anything. But 14th of August, Christiansburg, Virginia, right by Blacksburg, right by Virginia Tech, at the Starlight Drive-In. They're going to have wrestling in a movie there. Me and Misty both will be there. And then the big one I want to talk about is July the 9th. We're going to celebrate 25 years of Southern States Wrestling, my promotion that was set out to be like Continental and Mid-Atlantic and Memphis, a little mixture of all of them there. We are doing a free wrestling card at noon in Borden Park in Kingsport, Tennessee. Bring your lawn chairs. It's part of Village Fest, which is Fun Fest is going on that week. It's a citywide festival, and they do these block parties. Well, Village Fest is for the village. They're going to have free food, music, wrestling, pony rides, games, inflatables, you name it. They're going to have it there for everybody. Starts at 10 o'clock in the morning. Wrestling goes on at 12. Then we're going to tear down, load up, go 13 miles to Gray, Tennessee, to the Appalachian Fairgrounds. And at 6 o'clock that night, we're going to have our 25th anniversary spectacular. I got a lot of guys, if you follow that, or you can go to King of Kingsport and watch our programs we upload every week. And I'm a few days behind from getting them up. I load them Sunday because I've been working on this relief. But I'm going to load them up tomorrow after this. But 6:15, big card there, same kind of deal. Free food, free music, free games, free you name it, wrestling. And after the wrestling matches, they're going to have fireworks. This is our third year of being there. It does 4,000 to 5,000 people every year for this five-hour festival. Village Fest does a few hundred people every year. So two free shows. So if you want to come in from out of town, you got a full day of wrestling. And I will be there, both of them, with my books. I'll have all three books there. I've got cases of books in here. The Do You Want to Be a Wrestler Kid, my autobiography. It takes all kinds of people, places, and things that make pro wrestling and the history of Kingsport Wrestling 1960 through 69, which also starts off with a 100-year history lesson on East Tennessee wrestling from the days of carnival wrestling through Southeastern, Continental, all the way to Smoky Mountain, then into the independents. So something there that will educate everybody. And, you know, any other thing I can think of, just follow me, kingofkingsport.com. Facebook, Pro Wrestler Bo James, B-E-A-U. Everybody misspells my name the first time. And on Twitter, King of Kingsport. And you can find me through Chris's stuff because we tag each other in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and it's been a great, great run here. Between the Sheets, the latest episode that is out when this is being taped is 1996, June 21st through the 27th. Birth of Austin 316, WCW legal issues, Hardcore Heaven 96, and just a lot of stuff going on that week. And
I wanted to throw a plug. I've not got to this one, but I think it was last week or the week before. Everything's running together right now. The one that you and Bix did about the plans for WCW
2001. Yeah.
Yes. And how that is what's going on now. It's not just entertaining. That's an educational list for wrestling fans, especially the ones that just came along. And I don't watch today's product, period, but I do read about it just to see what's going on. I read reviews and different stuff. But, man, I thought y'all did a great job on, you know, they're going right down the same path again.
And that was a year before they did the first brand split. But yeah, I mean, there's just so much similarities in that, and you'll see that, you know, and doing these shows, you can find the similarities and stuff that's going on today and stuff that was going on back then. And yeah, it's always an education for me every week to do them, and I'm glad to think that all the listeners are getting educated too. And
I have Brian Hildebrand's all of his sheets. Pam gave me all the stuff that he had, brother. I need to get in this box. They fill up one closet in my house. But, I mean, he's got all – I could not tell you how many newsletters. And I read all through all of them when I first got all the stuff. But I know there's got to be some gems in there that you and Bix have never seen, probably from
early. Brian was around in the 70s. You know, I've seen 70s newsletters and seen Brian Hildebrand's name there as a source. So yeah, that sounds awesome. That sounds fantastic. But I still haven't made the decision yet on the next show we're gonna do. We're make that decision today's Tuesday, so hopefully I have that done Wednesday and figure that out. It's a tough one this week. It's a lot there's some different shows we're looking at, so we gotta try to figure out which one we're gonna do. Wanna do an 80s show, but we'll see how it ends up going.
You do an 80s show, I better be on there.
Well, I'll tell you this, Bo. I've had people say, well,
you know, once this series is over, we want to hear Bo back on again. Well, Bo will be back on again, and I have some ideas for some stuff to do with Bo that should be that'd be pretty fun for him to do. It won't be limited to one thing. Let's put it that way. Like we've been here.
Yeah. You know, this series, folks, it's lasted almost as long as Continental lasted. he said, this is episode 28. I was thinking, oh, my God, we've done 35 just on Continental. Yeah,
but the five parts, man, you look, I mean, they've all been 3 or 4 hours. So, yeah.
Here's something. I'm just throwing this at you, and I'm going to throw this out to anybody listening, because we know for a fact many people that were involved in Continental have listened to this. We know that because they have told us, and they have told us we were doing a good job. If there is anything in there that we did wrong, tell us. And down the road some way, whether it's on mine or Chris, we'll correct it.
Yeah.
Because I want the history to be told right. So far, no one's, you know, called me up and threatened to beat me up or, you know, burn my house down or anything. Well, that's good. You know, I mean, hey, we want to make sure. So, I mean, if you people could see the notes that me and Chris have went through, you know, and just I have so much stuff in front of me while we do this show because we want to make sure it's right. But if you worked at Continental and you know us, just tell, hey, say, hey, you got this wrong, and we'll gladly correct it, which brings me up to this. Thank God I just said that, because I remember. I got a email that Rick Hazard is alive. And he is on Twitter, and I went and looked.
Wow.
And it seems to be that it is him.
Amazing.
Tom. Yes, so Tom Pritchard and Ricky Morton has told me for all these years that he's dead. Shame on you.
What did they say when you told me he was alive?
I saw Tom at Joe's funeral, and I'd forgot it, so I've actually just wrote this down to text Tom tomorrow, the picture of Rick Hazard. And he's on Twitter, Rick Hazard, another, whatever his birth last name is. And he's a car salesman. Oh, wow. In Atlanta. So he's near you there, Chris. But a guy sent me that. He said, oh, he's alive. I said, no, you're mistaken, blah, blah, blah. Next thing I get's a picture with him playing with his kid or grandkid or whoever in his Twitter, and I went and looked. Now, he's not tweeted in several months, but it's not like these parody tweets or whatever. I mean, he's trying to sell you cars and telling you about his kid. So, I mean, it's him. So as of several months ago, he was alive. So we totally got that wrong, but it wasn't just us. Everybody got that one wrong.
Amazing.
So.
Hey, you know. That's.
It happens.
It does. It does. It's crazy. All right.
So, sometime there, you know, on the between the sheets, you need to have Burrhead on with Bix. just to hear that conversation. And I can set that up if you need me.
Lord. Oh, that would be quite the show. Oh, man. Well, anyway, Bo, thank you for doing this series, man. This has been totally
awesome. Thank you. Like I said, I've been with so much, and now with all this stuff going on. But, hey, I love talking about old-time Southern wrestling, whether it's Mid-Atlantic, whether it's Georgia, whether it's Florida, which, you know, Mid-Atlantic, before Dusty got the book, ran here every other Sunday. I was ringside. Southeastern Continental ran Johnson City at times weekly. Then every other week I was at ringside, then on Knoxville. So, I mean, this is not just historically. I don't want to do it just historically, which I do want it to be told right. I just love reliving my childhood.
I love it too.
You know, yeah. You grew up in Georgia watching that 6-hour block of Joe Pedicino, and we had an 8-hour block up here on our local Fox when it was an independent station before it became Fox. You know, we read magazines. I mean, we knew about people before we ever saw them, you know, and it's a different day and age. But, hey, we can turn back the clock. They can never take our memories away from us.
That's true. Yeah, so thank you for doing this, and
Yeah, I know. I've gotten some people say lately, we're tired of hearing about the same stuff all the time. I heard one guy tweeted out to me, it's Exile on Same Street. Well, hey, when I do the series like this, I kind of want to do them all in order. I don't want to kind of break it up.
Right.
But don't worry.
Hey, buddy, there's only 7,000 more podcasts out there. You don't have to choose us. We thank you for choosing us, but you don't have to.
Don't worry. Exile will be going back to its different ways after this one. I don't think I'm going to be doing any more series for a while. I know I've done Smokey. I've done this one. So it's time to start going different directions, and we'll see what happens as we move down the road. But other than that, again, Bo, thank you. And this is Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
Back about 18 and 25, I left Tennessee very much alive. I never would have made it through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been riding on a Tennessee stud. Had some trouble with my sweetheart's pa. One of her brothers was a bad outlaw. I wrote a letter to my Uncle Fudd, and I rode away on a Tennessee stud. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood. There never was a horse like the Tennessee stud. Drifted on down into no man's land, across the river called the Rio Grande. Raced my horse with the Spaniard's foal till I got me a skin full of silver and gold. Me and the gambler, we couldn't agree. We got in a fight over Tennessee. I pulled our guns and he fell with a thud, and I rode away on the Tennessee stud.